Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is the 17th of the 4th month, 2026, and it's a Friday. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to tell tales of death. We're going to tell tales of death that lingers and slithers through the night like a serpent. We're going to talk, and who better to tell it than other Africans as well. Ladies and gentlemen, we as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership of the stories that we are going to hear on Pulling Heartstrings. They are strictly for illustration purposes until the matriarch finishes writing the stories that she would like to share with you. But for today, let's indulge.
Where is this place?
Mother, but you're dead.
Do not be afraid, my child. Death is not the end of love.
You are destined for the throne, and I am here to help you achieve that. I want to teach you how to dance.
Three-year-old Amarachi was on her way home that hot afternoon, walking down the narrow bush path, a heavy bundle of firewood balanced carefully on her head. Just as she approached the edge of the village square, a loud, echoing voice pierced through the air. It was the Umuoma town crier. People began to gather immediately, rushing from their huts, market stalls and compounds. Amarachi stopped too, wanting to hear what message the king had for his people.
Hear ye! Hear ye! By the order of His Royal Majesty King Ikenga of Umuoma, I announce to you that Prince Ejiofo, the only son and heir apparent to the throne of Umuoma, has declared his intention to take a wife. All maidens of marriageable age are to prepare for a grand dance competition. The maiden who emerges victorious shall be crowned queen-in-waiting and wife to the prince.
The entire square exploded in excitement. But Amarachi didn't even turn her head. Instead, she adjusted the firewood on her head and continued walking, her steps steady, her face expressionless. Because deep down, she knew one thing. That announcement was not meant for someone like her. She was an orphan who had lost her parents to a strange sickness 2 years back. Her father's wealthy brother, Uncle Amadi, took her in. He took good care of her and loved her like his own. His wife and their only daughter, her cousin, Nyideka, however, didn't love her as much. They had turned her into a slave. She did all of the house chores. They treated her like trash any time her uncle was away. But immediately he returned, they suddenly became nice again. Amarachi knew she didn't stand any chance in the competition. Besides, she wasn't a good dancer like her cousin, Njideka, who was known as the best dancer in Umuoma land. So she continued on her way home. By the time she reached her uncle's compound, the noise of celebration still echoed faintly behind her. But inside the compound, reality waited. The moment she stepped through the gate, a sharp voice sliced through the air. "Amarachi, where have you been since morning?" Her uncle's wife stood at the center of the compound, eyes burning with irritation. Her name was Madame Ifunanya. Beside her stood her daughter, Nyideka, dressed neatly, her skin glowing with oil, her lips curved in quiet mockery. Amarachi lowered her gaze immediately. I went to fetch firewood, Ma. Before she could finish, the woman hissed. And does it take the whole day to bring firewood, lazy girl? Amarachi quickly bent, easing the heavy load from her head onto the ground. "Don't just stand there like a statue," Madame Ifunanya snapped. "Go and fetch water, then clean the kitchen. After that, pound yam for dinner." Amarachi nodded softly. "Yes, ma," Njideka chuckled quietly, folding her arms. She was about the same age with Amarachi, yet she did nothing in the house. Later that night, after hours of endless chores, Amarachi finally slipped into her room. She lay down gently on her bed. For a long moment, she stared into the darkness. Then her mind drifted back to a moment she had tried so hard to forget. 1 week earlier, she had gone to the stream to fetch water. It was very early in the morning, and people hardly visited the stream at that time. She bent down, just about to fill her pot with water, when she heard footsteps behind her. She turned slowly and saw Prince Ejiofor standing tall, flanked by a guard. She froze instantly, her heart pounding wildly in her chest. Prince Ejiofor stared at her for a while, looking surprised. Then he took a step closer, his voice calm yet strangely gentle. "What is your name?" Amarachi couldn't speak. Her throat had gone dry. "I asked for your name," he repeated, a small smile forming on his lips. She swallowed hard. "Amarachi," she whispered. The prince nodded slowly, as though tasting the name. "Amarachi," he repeated softly. "It suits you." Then he said something that had stayed with her ever since. He said, "I like you." Amarachi was shocked. She didn't even know how to respond. The only thing that came to mind was for her to run. Without another word, she quickly bent, filled her pot with water, lifted it onto her head, and ran. She didn't look back. She didn't speak, because she knew someone like her had no place in the world of princes. Back in her room, Amarachi turned to her side, pulling her wrapper closer to her body. Deep in her heart, she felt something for the prince, too. But she knew she didn't stand a chance. She closed her eyes slowly and let sleep take her. As soon as Amarachi fell asleep, something shifted. As though something unseen had gently lifted her out of her body, she found herself walking along a narrow, bushy path. The air felt cool against her skin as she moved. She could not remember taking the first step or choosing the direction, yet something pulled her forward. After a few more steps, the path opened into a small clearing. At the center of it stood a hut, simple and lonely, but strangely beautiful. Amarachi looked around slowly, confusion written all over her face. She took a cautious step closer. Then she heard her name. "Amarachi." She froze instantly. The voice sounded familiar. She turned and looked around, but didn't see anyone. She took another step, then heard her name again. This time, the voice was clearer. Her eyes widened, because now, there was no doubt, she knew that voice. Slowly, she turned toward the hut again. And that was when she saw movement from behind the hut. Someone stepped out. Amarachi stood glued to the spot, as her mouth opened wide in shock. Standing a few steps away, smiling, dressed in white that seemed to glow under a light that had no source, was her late mother Amarachi staggered back, her eyes wide with terror.
Mama? Her voice shook violently. "But you're dead,"
She wanted to run, but her legs refused to move. The woman smiled gently. "Do not be afraid, my child," she said softly. "Death is not the end of love. I have come to help you." Amarachi's lips trembled, but her mother ignored her and continued, "A chick that will grow into a rooster does not crow in the egg," she said. "The child who is destined for the crown may sleep on the floor today, but the sky does not forget its star." Stepping even closer, she added, "When the drumbeat of destiny begins, even the lame will find their feet. You are destined for the throne, and I am here to help you achieve that." Amarachi chuckled. "I am not meant for any throne," she whispered. "I am a slave in my uncle's house. I have no place among royalty." Her mother smiled again. "You see chains," she said gently. "But I see a crown. I have come to teach you how to dance, so you can take your rightful place in the palace." Amarachi let out a small, unbelieving laugh. "Dance? Mama, you, of all people, know that I do not know how to dance. Dancing has never been my thing.
Cyber threats are no longer just an IT problem. They are a risk to our national security and the core of our economy. Join various leaders and industry stakeholders at the 3rd Namibia International Cybersecurity Conference and Exhibition, NICSC 2026, taking place from the 22nd to the 24th of April at Arabush Travelodge in Windhoek. Corporate early bird registrations close on the 31st of March. So register now at dstech.com.in. NICSC 2026, securing Africa's digital future.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression.
My cousin, Njideka, dances better than me or anyone else in this kingdom. I know she will win, and I wish her the best. Apart from her, there are other good dancers in the kingdom. I cannot compete with them. Her mother's eyes glowed softly. She stretched out her hand and said, "Come, follow me." Amarachi obeyed. Without another word, her mother began to take some dance steps. She began to teach Amarachi how to dance. Amarachi's first attempt was clumsy and unbalanced, but slowly, she began to get the steps correctly after several trials. Her mother taught her for a while, swaying in a way that made Amarachi marvel. When she finally stopped, Amarachi stood there, breathing heavily, her chest rising and falling. Her mother smiled proudly. "Listen carefully, Amarachi. Make sure you rehearse the dance steps in your room when you retire for the night, after the day's work. We will meet here every day till the day for the competition arrives." After she was done talking, she turned and walked back to the hut. She faded away slowly as she walked, the glow around her dimming. In her room, Amarachi woke up with a sharp gasp. Her heart pounded wildly. Her body was drenched in sweat. She looked around the room. It was a dream, but why did it feel so real? She whispered. Slowly, she stood up, and without thinking, she took a step, then another. She began to dance, effortlessly, exactly as in the dream. She smiled out of excitement as she continued to dance, something she couldn't do before. Morning came quickly, and reality returned. Her name was shouted. "Amarachi, wake up!" She rushed out and began her chores immediately. It was always like that, whenever her uncle was away. But whenever he was around, his wife and daughter treated her nicely As she went about her chores that day, she smiled to herself. At one corner of the compound, Njideke stood proudly, dancing, her body swaying confidently. She spun, stamped, and turned with practiced ease. "There is no dancer like me in this kingdom," she boasted. Her mother clapped excitedly. "My daughter, the future queen!" Njideke laughed proudly. "That crown already belongs to me." Across the kingdom, the same scene repeated. In one compound, young maiden danced in groups, laughing and correcting each other. In another, a wealthy chief had hired a professional dancer from a neighboring kingdom to train his daughter day and night. Drums echoed from different directions. Excitement filled the air. Everywhere, maidens were preparing. While almost all the maidens of the kingdom rehearsed different dance steps during the day, Amarachi moved silently around the compound, carrying water pots, cleaning and cooking. Then at night, while they all slept, her late mother taught her how to dance. In the spirit realm, it became a ritual. Each time Amarachi lay down to sleep, the world she knew faded, and the same narrow bush path returned. She would see herself walking down the path, and at the end of it, the hut would be waiting. Her mother would always be there, waiting to teach her new dance steps. Night after night, she learned new steps, new movements that seemed to come from somewhere deeper than the body. Her mother did not just teach her how to move, she taught her how to feel the dance. "Do not dance with your legs alone," she would say. "Dance with your soul." And each night, when the rehearsal was over, she would wake up in her small room. Every night, before she went to bed, she rehearsed all she had been taught. Days passed. The village grew more competitive. Drums echoed from every corner as the maidens rehearsed. Njideke danced every day in the compound, confident that she would win. Her mother would clap and laugh, calling her the future queen. Then, 3 days to the competition, something changed. That night, when Amarachi reached the hut, her mother did not smile immediately. "Today," she said slowly, "I will teach you the final dance. This is not just a dance. It is a revelation." She stepped closer, her eyes glowing softly. "I call it the dance of the rising flame." The air around them shifted. The leaves trembled. "Listen carefully," her mother said. "This dance is not for the beginning. It is for the final lap of the competition, when many maidens have been screened out. At this point, you might feel alone and begin to doubt yourself. That is when you release the flame." Then she began to dance. The movement was unlike anything Amarachi had ever seen. It was not just graceful. It was commanding. Her body moved like fire, and each step carried power. Each movement demanded attention. Amarachi tried to follow. At first few trials, she failed. But her mother held her shoulders, helping her take one step at a time until her body aligned, her movements flowed, and suddenly she wasn't copying anymore. She was dancing. Her mother watched, and for the first time she nodded in full approval. "When the moment comes," she said softly, "this dance will announce you." She stepped back slowly. "Use it. Only at the final stage." Amarachi nodded, breathless. The training was complete. The day before the day, her uncle, Amadi, who had been away, returned. The compound changed immediately. His presence carried authority. As always, Madame Ifunanya and Nudica, her daughter, became nice to Amarachi again. That night, after dinner, Amadi called Amarachi and Nudica. They both walked up to him. "Are you both prepared for the competition tomorrow?" he asked them. Amarachi opened her mouth to speak, but before a word could leave her lips, Madame Ifunanya rushed in from the backyard. "Prepared?" she laughed loudly. "My daughter is more than prepared." She placed her hands proudly on Nudeka's shoulders. "This one will take the crown without stress." Nudeka smiled confidently, enjoying every word. She didn't even glance at Amarachi. Amarachi slowly closed her mouth. The moment passed. That night, Amarachi did her final rehearsal, alone in her room. The next day, the kingdom exploded with excitement. It was the long-awaited day. Every compound came alive. Young maidens dressed in their finest wrappers, beads, anklets, hair beautifully styled, faces glowing with hope. Njidika stepped out like royalty, dressed elegantly, her mother beside her, equally radiant. Amadi, being a chief, had left earlier. Just before leaving, Madame Ifunanya turned to Amarachi. "Please feed the chickens and clean their house thoroughly, okay?" "Okay," Amarachi responded. After they had left, Amarachi stood still for a moment. Then slowly she walked into her room. She brought out her mother's clothes, a beautiful wrapper and blouse. She took a deep breath, then dressed up in them. She made her way to the village square where the competition was to take place. By the time she arrived, the village square was already filled. The competition was about to begin. The maidens stood in lines, ready. She quickly joined them, and immediately people began to murmur. "What is she doing here?" the maidens asked each other. Nudeka's eyes widened in shock. Her mother's face hardened instantly. She was really angry. Other maidens began to laugh. "She wants to dance? She doesn't even know how to move? This will be interesting." Amarachi stood quietly. No one stopped her. No one sent her away, because no one believed she stood a chance. They thought she had come to disgrace herself. On the royal platform sat the king, his queen Neka, and Prince Ejiofor. The maidens were 30 in all. The royal announcer stepped forward. "Let the first stage begin." The drums exploded. The village musical band began to sing. Voices rose in rhythm. Drums beat deep and powerful. All 30 maidens moved together as they began to dance to the rhythm of the music. Njidika danced like a queen already crowned, her movements sharp, commanding attention. But then, eyes began to shift. Whispers spread. Heads turned. Amarachi moved differently, gracefully, as though the music lived inside her. Nudeka noticed. Her brows tightened slightly, but she continued. The music ended. End of stage one. The judges consulted quickly, and one of them stood up. 15 maidens will proceed to the next stage, he announced. Names were called. Amarachi and Nudeka were among them. 15 were eliminated. The drums returned faster, and the remaining 15 maidens began to dance. They danced with everything they had, no holding back. Nudeka intensified her performance. Her body moved with precision, her confidence radiating. But Amarachi was something else entirely. She did not dance to impress. She danced as though she was telling a story only she understood. Her body flowed like water. Her feet moved like the wind. Her presence was magnetic. When the music stopped again, silence fell. 8 more maidens were disqualified. Amarachi and Nidika were among the 7 that were to proceed to the next stage, including Somto, a strong dancer. At the 3rd stage, they didn't dance as a group anymore. They danced one by one under the eyes of the entire kingdom. Each maiden gave her best, but not all could withstand the pressure. By the end, only 3 remained: Amarachi, Nideka, and Somto. The arena roared. The tension was unbearable. The announcer stepped forward again, his voice louder. For the final stage, each maiden will choose the song she wishes to dance to. Somto was asked to dance first. She stepped forward and chose a song. The band began to sing. Somto danced beautifully. The crowd applauded. Next, Nideka stepped forward and chose her song. The band began to sing, and Nideka danced like her life depended on it. This was her best performance. Her very best. When she finished, the village square erupted. People stood up, clapping loudly and shouting, "She has won! The crown is her!"
Your car? That heartbeat is every part working perfectly together. At Motovec, we don't just sell parts. We keep your car alive. From brakes to batteries, filters to fluids, we power every drive, every trip, every moment. Motovec, the heartbeat behind your journey.
Efiloshisho utalikulandula kona vewayuka. Ekwashilipale kolo marwendo paiwano kupitila mo NHB. Watukwatele komesho kwashilipale kola fika mafio pedola emiliona omlongo danamibia. Moshi yoshe tukeshe kuyanja omakwafo unamiti enashane filoshisho lo paulumo mumbu. Kwa voveli ponje yoshilongo, shijoshi topo washo ijo yetu, tashiningwa inapawe banando ishoshe layash. Opo umone ya kulolo polis maule ominute disyonailela, lishangifako nhp.com.na. Omanga ino ya morwendo. Ponjeo Shilong, Emangono Malandula Fano, or Dodino Kulandurwa. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Buzz! Njideka smiled, breathing heavily, but certain that she had won. Even her mother was already celebrating. Then, silence fell again. All eyes turned. It was Amarachi's turn. She stepped forward slowly. Calm, humble, and unshaken, she bowed slightly, then said softly, "Please, sing Mort Noro, the song of the spirit." The band hesitated for a second, then the music began. Amarachi closed her eyes. Just for a moment. Then she moved. It began gently, like a whisper. Then she began to sway. Gradually her body moved like fire awakening. Her feet struck the ground with purpose. Her hands told stories words could never explain. She was not just dancing. She was becoming something else. With every passion within her, she released the dance of the rising flame, and everyone was captivated. The village square fell silent. People stared, frozen, as her movements grew stronger. She spun, and it felt like the wind moved with her. When she stamped, the ground seemed to answer. She was still dancing when people began to stand, without realizing it. Others covered their mouths in shock. The chiefs leaned forward. The elders nodded slowly. Even Queen Necker could not remain seated. She stood up, her eyes locked on Amarachi. She was captivated, because what they were witnessing was not just dance, it was destiny. Before Amarachi even finished, the crowd erupted. Thunderous applause and shouts. Njideka stood frozen, her face pale, her confidence shattered. Amarachi completed the final step and held still. Then the announcer's voice rang out. Amarachi was declared the winner. The arena exploded. Cheers, screams, celebration. Amarachi stood still, tears in her eyes, her chest rising and falling. She had done it. She was not allowed to return home. Immediately, she was led forward through the cheering crowd up toward the royal platform. And there, standing tall and waiting, was Prince Ejiofor. As she drew closer, he smiled even more. He stepped forward, still holding Amarachi's hand. The noise of the crowd slowly faded as he raised his free hand. He looked at Amarachi for a brief moment, then turned to the crowd and began to speak. "I will tell you the truth." His voice was calm, yet carried across the entire kingdom. "The first time I saw her was not today. I met her at the stream, where she had gone to fetch water very early in the morning. I didn't expect to meet anybody at the stream at such a time, but she was there. Something about her. I could not explain it, but I knew instantly that I liked her. I asked for her name, and she told me, but before I could say anything more, she ran away. I was confused, so I turned to my guard and asked him who she was, and he told me she was an orphan living with her uncle. That night, I could not sleep. So I went to see my uncle, Ichi Anayo, the wise man. I told him about my encounter with the strange maiden at the stream and how I couldn't just get her out of my mind. He listened with rapt attention, and then he closed his eyes and made a silent consultation. When he opened them, he asked me a question I had always avoided. He asked, 'Are you ready to take a wife now and for the first time in my life?' I said, 'Yes.' He then told me that I should organize a dance competition. He said the spirit had spoken. He told me that if that maiden was truly meant for me, she would win. But he warned me not to interfere in the competition or selection process. Let the gods have their way,' he added. And so I obeyed. I told my father, King Ikenga, of my readiness to take a wife through a dance competition. He looked at Amarachi again. 'Today, the gods have spoken. And I have my bride, my wife, and the queen-in-waiting of Umwoma Kingdom.' The crowd erupted with cheers, shouts, and clapping. Immediately, royal attendants stepped forward with beads, coral ornaments, and fine wrappers. They led Amarachi into the inner chambers and began to decorate her. Soon, her rough, simple appearance disappeared and was replaced by royalty, grace, and honor. Then they led her out again, and the square erupted with excitement and cheers. Njideka stood frozen, her face filled with disbelief. She burst into tears, grabbed her mother's arm, and without a word, they turned and left the village square, their dreams shattered, their pride destroyed. But the rest of the kingdom celebrated. Amadi, Amarachi's uncle, stood proudly among the chiefs, his chest lifted, his face glowing with joy. "That is my niece. I am so proud of you, Amarachi," he whispered. Celebration began as different music and dancing groups entertained the excited crowd. Something rare had happened. The king and queen welcomed Amarachi wholeheartedly, not minding her status. Her late father, when he was alive, was a good man. That alone qualified her for royalty. Amarachi stood still, beside Prince Ejiofor, smiling through tears, tears of joy. She closed her eyes briefly and whispered, "Thank you, Mama." A gentle breeze passed through the village square briefly, almost like a touch. Amarachi opened her eyes slowly, and for a fleeting second, she felt her mother's presence. Dear viewers, sometimes the world may see you as nothing, but destiny sees you as everything you are meant to become. Never let your present condition silence your future glory. Thank you so much for watching.
You useless child! Look at you, a complete shame to this family. You are nothing but a mistake, do you hear me? A big mistake. Bastard! Good for nothing human. What have you ever done right? Nothing. You bring me nothing but pain and disgrace.
Mama, please.
Don't call me that. You don't deserve to call me your mother.
Look at her, always crying like a baby. She is so useless.
I am done with you. You are a regret I wish I could erase.
Long before schools, before city life, before roads were filled with cars, there was a quiet village called Muadax. It was a small village surrounded by thick forests, tall palm trees, and red earth that stained the feet of anyone who walked barefoot. The air in the morning was always cool, and the sound of birds singing filled the sky before the sun came out. In this village lived a young girl named Adaize. Adaize was the first daughter of a woman called Igode. From the outside, their home looked like every other home in Umuadax. Mud walls, thatched roof, and a small compound where chickens moved around freely. But inside that house, Adaize lived a life that no child should live. Adaize was not like other children in the village. While other girls her age laughed, played, and ran around in the village square, Adaize walked. She walked like a grown woman. Every single day, before the cock crowed, before the sun showed its face, Adaize would open her eyes. Sometimes, her body would still be heavy from the previous day's work, but she had no choice. She would slowly sit up from the mat she slept on, stretch her tired arms, and look around the dark room. The house would still be quiet. Her siblings would be sleeping peacefully. Her mother would still be lying down, but Adaize would quietly stand up. She would tie her wrapper firmly around her chest, carry her clay pot, and step outside into the cold morning air. The ground would be wet with dew. The sky would still be dark. And alone, Adaize would begin her journey to the stream. The path to the stream was not easy. It was long and sometimes lonely. Thick bushes surrounded the narrow path, and sometimes strange sounds would come from the forest. But Adaize was used to it. She walked fast, her bare feet pressing into the red earth, her eyes focused, her heart silent. When she reached the stream, she would kneel down, dip her pot into the water and fill it carefully. Then she would lift the heavy pot on her head. The weight would press down on her neck, but she did not complain. She would turn and walk all the way back home. When she reached the compound, she would gently drop the pot and take a deep breath. But her work was not done, not even close. She would pick up a broom and begin to sweep the entire compound. The dust would rise into the air and the sound of the broom brushing against the ground would echo in the quiet morning. By the time she finished sweeping, the sun would begin to rise. Then she would enter the kitchen. She would light the firewood, blow into the fire until it caught. Her eyes would water from the smoke, but she would keep going. She would cook for the entire family, boil water, prepare food, serve it. And only after everyone had eaten, she might get something small. Sometimes. Most times, she did not. Inside the house, her siblings would wake up slowly, stretching, yawning, talking, laughing. Lotachi, her younger brother, would roll on the mat and say loudly, "Adaize, is the food ready?" Adaize inside the kitchen would answer softly, "Yes, it is ready." The twins, Asama and Olama, would sit up and begin to talk. "Today I will wear the blue wrapper." "No, I want it," Olama would reply. They would argue, laugh, and tease each other. None of them would ask, "Adaize, have you eaten?" None of them would say, "Let us help you." Even their mother, Egode, would come out slowly, stretching her arms like someone who had rested well. She would look around the compound, then shout, "Adaize, why is the fire still burning like this? Do you want to finish all the firewood in this house?" Adaize would quickly respond, "I am sorry, Mama. I will reduce it." Egode would shake her head and hiss, "Useless girl. You do not know how to do anything properly." Adaize would go quiet. She would not answer. She never answered. After cooking, Adaize would prepare for the market. She would gather the items she wanted to sell, vegetables, small food items, sometimes firewood. She would arrange them carefully, then carry them on her head. The load would be heavy, very heavy, but she would walk, under the hot sun, all the way to the market. At the market, Adaize would sit on the ground with her goods, calling out to customers, "Come and buy fresh vegetables, come and buy."
Celebrate Namibia's Independence Month with amazing deals at Exodus Investment CC. Get solar lights for just 100 Namibian dollars. We also stock CCTV Wi-Fi cameras, TV mounts, DSTV and GoTV satellite TV accessories, plus replacement remotes for TVs, air conditioners and many other electronic accessories only at Exodus Investment CC. Visit us today at Shop 7 Blockchain Shopping Center in Katutura next to Bank Bentuk. We are open daily, including public holidays, from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. for your convenience. Call or WhatsApp 081-3191-395 and find us on social media. Exodus Investment CC, your trusted store for quality electronics and accessories. Hurry! Our Independence Special runs until the 13th of April 2026. And remember, Exodus Investment CC. We courier countrywide. Call us now.
Her voice would be calm. Her face would be gentle. Some people would buy from her. Some would ignore her. Some would price her goods too low. But Adaize would still smile. She would still sell. Hour after hour. Until the sun began to go down. By evening, Adaize would gather the little money she made, tie it carefully in her wrapper, and begin the long walk back home. Her legs would be weak, her body tired, her stomach empty, but she would still walk. When she finally reached the compound, she would drop her load and sit down for a moment, just to breathe, just to rest. But that moment never lasted, because immediately her mother's voice would rise. "Adaize, you are back." "Yes, Mama." "Where is the money?" Adaize would quietly untie the cloth around her waist, bring out the money and stretch her hand. Egode would collect it quickly, without saying thank you, without asking how the market went, without caring how Adaize felt. Lotachi would come closer. "Let me see how much she made," he would say. Asama and Olama would gather around. Egode would count the money, then smile slightly. "Good. Tomorrow I will buy new clothes for you people." She would look at the younger ones. The twins would jump with excitement. "Thank you, Mama." Lotachi would grin. Adaize would stand there, quiet, watching. No one would look at her. No one would ask, "What about you?" Sometimes Adaize would gather courage and say softly, "Mama, can I keep something small for myself?" Egode would turn sharply. "What did you say?" Adaize would lower her head. I just need a little." Egode would cut her off. "A little? For what? Are you the one feeding this family? Are you the one taking care of this house?" Adaize would go quiet, her throat tight. Egode would continue. "Everything you have belongs to this house. Or do you want to start behaving like a stubborn child?" Adaize would quickly shake her head. No, Mama. Then go inside. Adaize would turn and walk inside. Her eyes filled with tears, but she would not cry out loud. She never cried out loud. At night, after everyone had eaten, Adaize would sit quietly. Sometimes there would be no food left for her. Sometimes just a little. She would take whatever was there or nothing at all. Then she would lie down on her mat, her body aching, her stomach empty, her heart heavy. She would stare into the darkness, listening to the sounds of the night, the crickets, the distant voices, the wind, and slowly tears would roll down her face. She would whisper softly, "What did I do wrong? Why am I suffering like this? Chi, please, tell me, what did I do?" No one answered. No one heard her. Days turned into weeks. Weeks turned into months. But Adaize's life did not change. She kept working, she kept giving, she kept suffering. And inside that same house, her siblings continued to live freely, laughing, eating, enjoying, depending on her. Because deep inside their hearts, even if they never said it, they knew one thing, that if Adaize ever stopped, if Adaize ever left, their lives would become hard, very hard. And so, without saying it, without admitting it, they held on to her, not with love, but with need. One evening, as Adaize returned from the market, more tired than usual, she slowly dropped her load and sat down on a small stool. Her legs were shaking, her hands weak. For the first time, she did not stand up immediately. She just sat there, quiet, breathing. Egode came out and saw her. "What are you doing there like that?" Adaize looked up slowly. "I'm just resting, Mama." Egode frowned. "Resting? Did I send you to the market to go and rest? Or do you want everyone to sleep hungry?" Adaize quickly stood up. "I am sorry, Mama." Egode hissed. "Useless girl. Go inside and start cooking." Adaize nodded. "Yes, Mama." She picked herself up, slowly, and walked into the kitchen. Her body tired, but her spirit still holding on. Because no matter how much they treated her, no matter how much they took from her, Adaize still did everything. She still walked, she still cared, she still endured. Because deep inside her heart, there was still a small hope, a small belief, that one day, something would change. And maybe, just maybe, she would finally find peace. In the quiet village of Umuadax, people knew Egodi as a strong woman. But inside her home, she was something else. Egodi was not just strict. She was bitter. Very bitter. It was a kind of bitterness that lived deep inside her heart. A bitterness that made her eyes hard. A bitterness that made her voice sharp. A bitterness that did not allow her to show kindness, especially to one person, Adaize. Every morning in that house began the same way. Before the sun came out, before the birds started singing loudly, Adaize was already awake and working. But Egodi never saw it as something good. Instead, she always found something wrong. One morning, Adaize was sweeping the compound as usual. The ground was still cold, and her hands moved quickly with the broom. Egodi stepped outside, wrapped in her cloth, and looked around. She frowned. "Adaize!" she shouted. Adaize quickly stopped sweeping and turned. "Yes, Mama." "What is this nonsense you are doing?" Egodi snapped. Adaize looked confused. "Mama, I am sweeping." Egodi walked closer, pointing at the ground. "Is this how to sweep? Look at this place. Look at that corner. Are you blind?" Adaize looked at the spot. "It is clean, Mama." Before she could finish, Egodi cut her off. "Are you arguing with me?" "No, Mama," Adaize said quickly, lowering her head. "Then sweep it again." Adaize nodded. "Yes, Mama." She bent down and started sweeping the same place again. Her hands moved slowly now. Her heart felt heavy. Inside the house, the twins, Asama and Olama, were awake. They were sitting together, plaiting each other's hair. They heard Egodi shouting. Asama laughed softly. "See her, Mama has started again." Olama smiled. "That one is her work. Let her continue." Lotachi, who was lying down, stretched and said lazily, Adaeze will never get anything right in this house. They all laughed. No one felt pity. No one cared. To them, Adaeze was just someone who worked. That was all. Later that morning, Adaeze finished cooking and served the food. She placed the food carefully in front of her mother and siblings. Egudi sat down first. Lotachi followed. The twins sat beside each other. They all started eating. Adaeze stood there, watching, waiting. After a while, she gathered courage. Mama, should I serve myself? Egudi looked up slowly. Serve yourself, she repeated. Adaeze swallowed. Yes, Mama. Egudi laughed in a dry way. From where? Adaeze looked at the pot. There is still small food. Egudi's face changed. Small food, she said. Yes, Mama. Egudi dropped her spoon. Do you want your siblings to go hungry? No, Mama. Then why are you asking for food like a greedy child? Adaeze quickly shook her head. I am not greedy, Mama. Then go and bring water for us to drink, Egudi said sharply. Adaeze nodded. Yes, Mama. She turned and walked away. Her stomach was empty, but she said nothing. She never said anything. As she walked to get water, tears filled her eyes, but she blinked them away. She had learnt one thing in that house. Crying did not change anything. Later that day, Adaeze prepared for the market. She carried her goods and walked out. As she left, she heard the twins talking. Asama, when Mama gets money today, I want new beads, Olama said. And I want new cloth, Asama replied. Lotachi added, I will collect my own money from Mama too. They were already planning how to spend the money Adaeze had not even made yet. Adaeze paused for a moment, just for a second. Then she continued walking, her face calm, but her heart heavy. At the market, Adaeze worked hard as usual. She called customers, she smiled, she sold her goods. But inside her, something was different. She was tired. Not just her body, her heart, her spirit, everything. As the sun went down, she gathered her money and returned home. When she reached the compound, Egudi was waiting. Adaeze, come here. Adaeze walked closer. Yes, Mama. Where is the money? She brought it out and gave it to her. Egudi counted it, then frowned. This is all? Yes, Mama. Egudi looked at her with anger. What do you mean by yes, Mama? Where is the rest? That is all I made today. Before Adaeze could finish, Egudi slapped her. The sound was loud. Adaeze staggered back. Her cheek burned. Her eyes filled with tears. You think I'm a fool? Egudi shouted. No, Mama. Then where is the money? That is all, Mama. Egudi raised her hand again, but this time Lotachi spoke. Mama, maybe she's hiding it. Egudi looked at Adaeze. Open your wrapper. Adaeze's eyes widened. Mama, I am not hiding anything. Open it, Egudi shouted. Slowly, with shaking hands, Adaeze untied her wrapper slightly. There was nothing. Egudi looked at her for a moment, then hissed. Useless girl. She turned away. The twins were watching. Olama whispered, she's lucky Mama did not beat her well. Asama nodded, yes. Adaeze stood there, silent, her cheeks still hurting, her heart breaking slowly. That night, Adaeze lay on her mat. She did not eat. She was not given food. She stared at the roof. Tears rolled down her face. She whispered softly, why, Mama? Why do you hate me like this? But there was no answer. Days passed, then weeks. Egudi's behavior did not change. In fact, it became worse. She began to insult Adaeze more openly. One afternoon, while Adaeze was cooking, Egudi walked into the kitchen. What is this smell? She said. Adaeze turned. It is the soup, Mama. Egudi tasted it, then spat it out. Are you trying to poison us? Adaeze's heart jumped. No, Mama, I am not. Shut up, Egudi snapped. You cannot even cook properly. I am sorry, Mama. Sorry will not feed this family, Egudi shouted. She picked up the pot and poured the soup on the ground. Adaeze gasped. Mama? Start again, Egudi said. Adaeze looked at the spilled food, her eyes filled with tears. That was all they had. Now it was gone. But she said nothing. She bent down, cleaned the mess, and started cooking again, from the beginning. Inside the house, Lotachi laughed. See her life. The twins joined. She deserves it, Olama said. Adaeze heard them, every word, but she kept quiet, because in that house, her voice had no value. One evening, Adaeze came back from the market very late. She was tired, very tired. Her legs were weak. Her head ached. She dropped her load and sat down, just for a moment, just to breathe. Egodi saw her. What are you doing? She shouted. Adaeze looked up. I am just resting, Mama. Resting? Egodi repeated. Yes, Mama. Egodi walked closer. Did I send you to the market to rest? Adaeze quickly stood up. I am sorry. Sorry, 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 Egodi mocked. That is all you know to say. Adaeze lowered her head. Egodi continued. You think this house will run itself? No, Mama. Then go inside and cook. Adaeze nodded. Yes, Mama. She turned and walked into the kitchen, her body weak, her heart tired, but she still worked. She always worked. That night, as she lay down, something inside her changed. Not anger, not hate, just pain, deep pain, a pain that sat quietly inside her like a wound that never healed. She closed her eyes, and for the first time, she said softly, one day, my life will change. Her voice was calm, not loud, not strong, but there was something in it, something quiet, something.
Goeie nuus, Imba het nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. As jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Imba te geniet, kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Imba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Imba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
Hopeful, and in that small broken heart, that tiny hope remained, even in the middle of pain, even in the middle of cruelty, even in the middle of a mother's cold heart, Adaeze still believed that one day she would find peace. Time did not stand still. Days passed, seasons changed, children grew, and Adaeze became a woman. She was no longer the small girl who followed her mother around. She had grown tall with smooth, dark skin that shined under the sun. Her face was calm and beautiful. Not loud, not proud, but gentle. Her eyes carried something deeper. Pain, strength, and silence. People in the village began to notice her. Not just because she was beautiful, but because she was hard-working. Everybody knew Adaeze. They knew her as the girl who walked before everyone. The girl who fetched water alone. The girl who walked in the market without complaining. The girl who never insulted anyone. The girl who always greeted elders with respect. Sometimes women in the village would whisper to each other, "That girl, she's different." Yes, very different. She will make a good wife. But inside Adaeze's house, nothing had changed. She was still treated like nothing, still insulted, still used, still hungry most nights, still alone. Yet, as she grew older, something new began to happen. Men started coming. Men who wanted to marry her. Men who saw her value. Men who saw what her family refused to see. The first man came one afternoon. The sun was high and the compound was quiet. Adaeze was in the kitchen preparing food. Her hands were busy, her face calm. Outside, a young man stood at the entrance of the compound. He was neat, simple, respectful. He cleared his throat. "Is anybody home?" he called. Asama, who was sitting outside, looked up. "Yes, what do you want?" she asked. "I came to see the family," the man replied. Lotachi stepped forward. "What family?" he said. This family, the man answered. Lotachi looked at him from head to toe. What do you want here? The man took a deep breath. I came to ask for Adeazi. Silence fell. Asama looked at Olama. Olama looked at Lotachi. Lotachi's face changed. Ask for who? He said slowly. For Adeazi, the man repeated. Lotachi laughed, a dry, mocking laugh. You want to marry Adeazi? Yes, the man said. Lotachi shook his head. You see this one, he said, turning to the twins. Another one has come. The twins started laughing. Inside the kitchen, Adeazi heard everything. Her hands froze. Her heart started beating fast. Someone came for her. Her chest felt tight. She did not move. She did not speak. She just listened. Outside, Lotachi stepped closer to the man. Who sent you? He asked. No one sent me. I came because I want her. Lotachi's eyes became hard. You want her? Yes. For what? For marriage. Lotachi laughed again. Then suddenly, his face changed. Without warning, he turned and ran inside. The man stood there, confused. What is happening? He asked. Before anyone could answer, Lotachi came back, holding a cutlass. His face was serious, his eyes angry. Leave this place, he shouted. The man stepped back. What did I do? You came to steal from us, Lotachi yelled. Steal? The man asked. Yes, you want to carry our source of food away. I don't understand. You don't understand, Lotachi said, raising the cutlass. If you don't leave now, you will understand. The man raised his hands. Please, I came with respect. Leave, Lotachi shouted again. The man looked around. No one defended him. No one spoke for him. Even the twins were laughing. Slowly, he stepped back, then turned and walked away. Inside the kitchen, Adeazi was stood still, her eyes filled with tears, her heart broken. Someone came for her, but he was chased away, like an animal. That night, Adeazi lay under the moon, her eyes open, her heart heavy. She whispered softly, "Why? Why will they not allow me to be happy?" No one answered her. Days passed, then another man came. This one was older, calm, respectful. He came with a small gift, palm wine, kola nuts. He greeted Egodi properly. Good afternoon, Mama. Egodi looked at him. What do you want? He said, I came to speak about your daughter. Which daughter? Adeazi. Egodi looked at him carefully. What about her? I want to marry her. Silence. The twins stopped talking. Lotachi stepped closer. Egodi sat down slowly, then smiled. But it was not a kind smile. It was a dangerous one. You want to marry her? Yes. Do you know what it takes? The man nodded. I am ready. Egodi laughed softly. Ready? Yes, Mama. Egodi looked at Lotachi. Lotachi smiled. Then he disappeared inside. After some time, he came back with a long piece of paper. He handed it to Egodi. Egodi gave it to the man. Read, she said. The man opened it. His eyes moved across the paper, slowly, then faster. His face changed. What is this? He asked. Egodi crossed her arms. That is the list. List of what? Everything we have spent on Adeazi since she was born. The man looked confused. I don't understand. Egodi leaned forward. You want to marry her? Yes. Then you must pay for everything. Everything? Yes. The man looked at the paper again. Socks, food, cloth, oil, firewood. He looked up. Mama, this is too much. Egodi's face hardened. Too much? Yes. Lotachi stepped forward. If it is too much, then leave her. The man swallowed. I came with good intentions. Egodi laughed. Good intentions will not feed this house. The twins joined. Yes, pay or leave. The man stood there, his pride broken, his heart heavy. Slowly, he folded the paper, placed it down, and said quietly, I cannot do this. Egodi waved her hand. Then go. The man turned and left, just like that. Inside the house, Adeaze was listening. Every word, every insult, every rejection. Her heart sank. Another chance gone. That night, she cried. Not loudly, but deeply. She whispered softly, "Is it wrong to want love? Is it wrong to want my own home?" Her voice broke. "Why do they hate my happiness?" Time passed. More men came, and the same thing happened. Some were chased with insults, some were threatened, some were given impossible demands, and one by one, they all left. No one stayed, no one fought, no one returned, because Adeaze's family made sure of it. Inside the house, nothing changed. They continued to depend on her, to use her, to control her, because deep inside them, they knew if Adeaze married, their comfort would end. So they held her back, not with love, but with fear. One evening, after a long day in the market, Adeaze sat alone outside. The sun was setting, the sky was quiet, the air was calm. She looked up at the moon, her eyes filled with tears. She whispered softly, "Chi, I am tired. I am very tired." Her voice broke. "I work every day. I give everything, but I have nothing." Tears rolled down her face. "Even love, they will not allow me." She placed her hand on her chest. "My heart is hurting." She closed her eyes. "But," she whispered, "I will not give up." Her voice became softer, stronger. One day my own will come." She wiped her tears slowly and stood up, her body tired, but her spirit still holding on. Because even though her family denied her love, even though they broke her heart again and again, Adeaze still believed that somewhere, somehow, love would find her. One day, the sun was still high in the sky when Adeaze returned from the stream. Her clay pot was full of water, balanced carefully on her head. Her steps were slow but steady. Sweat covered her body, and her wrapper was slightly wet from the heat. She had already been walking since early morning, and her body was beginning to feel tired. As she walked along the narrow path that led back home, she heard voices. At first, she ignored it. But then, she recognized one of the voices. It was Olama. Adeaze stopped walking. She stood still. Her heart began to beat faster. "What is Olama doing here?" she whispered to herself. Olama was not supposed to be anywhere near that part of the path. That area was quiet and hidden, close to the bush. It was not a place where young girls should be. Adeaze slowly turned her head. She moved quietly, gently stepping behind a tree so she could see without being seen. And then she saw them, Olama and a man. Adaize's eyes widened. The man was tall, dark, and rough-looking. His body language was bold, careless. His face carried no shame, no respect. Adeaze knew him. Everybody in the village knew him. Ikenta, a man feared by many. A man known for destroying young girls. A man who moved from one woman to another, leaving pain behind him. Adaize's heart dropped. "No, no," she whispered. She watched as Ikenta stood close to Olama. Too close. Olama was smiling, laughing, playing with her wrapper. Ikenta reached out and touched her hand. Adeaze felt her chest tighten. "What is she doing?" she said under her breath. She stepped out from behind the tree. "Olama!" The voice was sharp, strong. Olama froze. Her smile disappeared immediately. She turned. And when she saw Adeaze, her face changed. Shock, fear, guilt, everything showed at once. "Adeaze," she stammered. Ikenta looked at Adeaze, then smiled. A slow, shameless smile. "What is it?" he said. Adaeze ignored him. She walked straight to Olama. "What are you doing here?" she asked. Olama swallowed. I was just... "Just what?" Adaeze asked, her voice firm. Olama looked at Ekenta, then back at Adaeze. "I was just talking," she said. "Talking?" Adaeze repeated. Her eyes filled with disappointment. "You are talking with him?" she asked. Ekenta laughed. "What is wrong with talking to me?" he said. Adaeze turned to him sharply. "Do not speak," she said. Ekenta raised his hand slightly. "All right," he said, still smiling. Adaeze turned back to Olama. "Do you know who he is?" she asked. Olama said nothing. "Answer me," Adaeze said. Olama looked down. "Yes." "And you are standing here with him?" Adaeze continued. Olama became defensive. "What is wrong with that?" she said. Adaeze stepped back slightly. "What is wrong?" she repeated. "Yes," Olama said. "Adaeze, I am not a child." Adaeze shook her head slowly. "I am not saying you are a child. But this man, what about him?" Olama interrupted. "He is dangerous," Adaeze said. Olama laughed. "Dangerous?" she said. "Yes," Adaeze replied. "He has destroyed many girls in this village." "That is what people say," Olama replied quickly. "It is the truth," Adaeze said. Olama crossed her arms. "Or maybe you are just jealous," she said.
Get more for less at Voerman Brock. Like a 2 kg bag of nice rice for just $32.99. 100-gram Nescafe Rick Coffee, now only $29.99. A 2-liter Coca-Cola for a sweet $21.99. And 2 kg Surf hand wash powder, now just $49.99. See more mid-month deals at voermanbrock.com. We care.
Adaeze froze. "Jealous?" she asked. "Yes," Olama said. "You think no man will look at me because you are older." Adaeze stared at her. "I am not jealous of you," she said quietly. "I am worried about you." Olama shook her head slowly. "I did not ask for your worry." Adaeze sighed. "Olama, listen to me." "I am not listening," Olama shouted. Ekenta stepped forward. "Let her go," he said. "She does not want to listen." Adaeze looked at him, her eyes full of anger. "You stay away from her," she said. Ekenta smiled again. "Or what?" he asked. Adaeze did not answer. She turned back to Olama. "Come home," she said. Olama said, "I am not going anywhere with you." Adaeze's voice softened. "Please, just come home." Olama hesitated. She looked at Ekenta, then at Adaeze. "Finally," she said, "fine." She turned to Ekenta. "I will see you later," she said. Ekenta nodded. "I will be waiting," he replied. Adaeze felt a chill run through her body. She did not say anything. She just turned and began to walk. Olama followed. Silence filled the air between them. When they reached home, Olama walked in quickly. Adaeze followed behind. Inside the compound, Egodi was sitting down with Asama and Lotachi. They were talking and laughing. But immediately Olama entered, she began to cry. Loudly. "Mama," she shouted. Egodi stood up immediately. "What is it?" she asked. Olama ran to her. "Mama, mama," she cried. Egodi held her. "What happened?" Olama pointed at Adaeze. "It is her," she said. Egodi turned. "What did she do?" Olama wiped her tears. "I saw her with the Kenta." Silence. Adaeze froze. "What?" Egodi said. "Yes," Olama cried. "I saw her with him in the bush." Egodi's face changed instantly. Adaize, Egodi shouted. Adaize stepped forward. Mama, that is not true. Shut up, Egodi yelled. Adaize stopped. Mama, please, Egodi moved closer. After everything I am doing for you, this is what you are doing? Adaize's voice trembled. Mama, please listen to me. I said shut up, Egodi shouted again. Asama stepped forward. I knew it, she said. Olama continued crying. I saw her with my own eyes, she said. Lotachi shook his head. Useless girl, he said. Adaize felt her chest tighten. Her eyes filled with tears. Mama, I am telling the truth. What truth? Egodi shouted. That I saw Olama with him, Olama gasped. She is lying, she shouted. I am not lying, Adaize said. Yes, you are, Olama replied. Egodi raised her hand and slapped Adaize hard. Do not call your sister a liar, Egodi shouted. Adaize staggered. Her cheek burned. Tears rolled down her face. I am not lying, she whispered. Egodi pointed at her. You have brought shame to this house. I did not. Enough, Egodi shouted. You will not speak again. Adaize's voice broke. Mama, but Egodi turned away. I don't want to hear your voice. Adaize stood there, broken, alone. Her truth rejected, her voice ignored. She looked around. No one believed her. Not her mother, not her siblings, no one. She slowly turned and walked inside, her steps heavy, her heart shattered. That night, Adaize sat outside under the moon. The same place she always went when her heart was too heavy. She hugged her knees, tears falling silently. Why? She whispered. Why is this happening to me? Her voice shook. I told the truth, but nobody listened. She closed her eyes. Why does my voice not matter? She wiped her tears slowly, then looked up at the sky. Chi, you know the truth. Her voice was soft. Even if nobody believes me, I know you do. She took a deep breath, her chest rising and falling. I will not stop being who I am. Her voice became stronger. I will not become like them. She stood up slowly, her body tired, but her spirit still standing. Because even when lies covered her truth, even when her own family turned against her, Adaize still chose to remain good, still chose to remain strong, still chose to believe that one day the truth would speak for her. Months passed after the day Olama lied against Adaize. Life in the house continued as if nothing had happened, but something had changed, not outside. Inside Adaize. She still woke up before the cock crowed. She still fetched water, still swept, still cooked, still went to the market, still brought money home, still gave everything. But inside her heart, something was broken. She no longer tried to explain herself. She no longer tried to defend herself. She had learned her lesson. In that house, truth did not matter. Only noise mattered. Only lies that sounded strong mattered. And Adaize was not loud. So she kept quiet, even when it hurt. Olama, on the other hand, had changed too, but not in a good way. She became more secretive, more restless, more distracted. She would leave the house at strange times. Return late, avoid eye contact. And when Adaize looked at her, Olama would look away quickly. Asama noticed it. Lotachi noticed it. Even Egodi noticed it. But no one said anything. No one asked questions. Because deep down, they did not want to hear answers. One evening, as Adaeze returned from the market, she saw Olama sitting quietly in a corner, not talking, not laughing, just sitting. That was unusual. Adaeze dropped her load slowly, then walked closer. Olama, she called gently. Olama looked up. Her face was pale. Her eyes looked tired. Yes, she answered softly. Adaeze sat beside her. What is wrong? She asked. Nothing, Olama replied quickly. Adaeze looked at her carefully. You don't look fine, she said. I am fine, Olama insisted. Adaeze sighed. Olama, leave me alone, Olama snapped suddenly. Adaeze went quiet. She stood up slowly. I am sorry, she said softly. Then she walked away. That night, Adaeze could not sleep well. Something was not right. She could feel it. Days passed. Then one morning, everything changed. Olama woke up and began to vomit. At first, they thought it was nothing, but it did not stop. She vomited again and again. Egodi became worried. What is wrong with you? She asked. I don't know, Olama replied weakly. Asama stepped closer. Maybe she ate something bad, she said. Lotachi shrugged. She will be fine. But Adaeze knew. Her heart began to beat fast. She looked at Olama carefully. Then she looked away. She did not speak. She was afraid. Afraid of what she was thinking. Days passed again. Olama's body began to change. She became weak. Her stomach started to show small signs. Egodi noticed. One afternoon, Egodi called her. Olama, come here. Olama walked slowly. Yes, Mama. Egodi looked at her, then at her stomach. What is happening to your body? She asked. Nothing, Olama said quickly. Egodi stood up. Do not lie to me. I am not lying. Egodi moved closer. Who is responsible? She asked. Olama froze. Silence filled the air. Answer me, Egodi shouted. Olama began to shake. Egodi raised her hand. I will not ask again. Tears filled Olama's eyes. It is Ikenta, she whispered. Silence. Heavy silence. Egodi stepped back. Her face changed. Shock. Anger. Shame. You said what? She asked slowly. Olama cried. It is Ikenta. Egodi screamed. You foolish girl. She slapped Olama hard. You have destroyed this family. Olama fell to the ground, crying. I am sorry, Mama. Sorry? Egodi shouted. Sorry will remove this shame. Adaeze stood at a distance, watching, her heart breaking. Not because she was surprised, but because it had finally happened. The truth had come out, but too late. Asama covered her mouth. Oh, no. Lotachi shook his head. I knew something was wrong. Egodi paced around, her hands on her head. What will people say? What will the village say? My daughter, pregnant for Ikenta? She stopped suddenly, then turned to Olama. Stand up. Olama stood slowly, still crying. Egodi pointed at her. You will not stay in this house. Mama, Olama cried. Keep quiet. Adaeze stepped forward. Mama, Egodi turned. What do you want? Adaeze swallowed. Mama, please, calm down. Calm down? Egodi shouted. Is this a time to calm down? Adaeze spoke softly. She needs help. Help? Egodi laughed bitterly. Where was your help when she was doing rubbish in the bush? Adaeze shook her head. I tried to warn her. Shut up, Egodi shouted. Adaeze went quiet. But then she spoke again, soft but firm. Mama, please, do not send her away. Egodi stared at her. Why? Adaeze took a deep breath. She is your daughter. Egodi's face hardened. And she has brought shame to me. Adaize's eyes filled with tears. She made a mistake. Egodi snapped. A big mistake. Adaize nodded slowly. Yes, but she needs protection. Egodi laughed coldly. Protection? Yes, Mama. Egodi pointed at the ground. This house cannot carry shame. Adaize's voice trembled. Mama? I said no, Egodi shouted. Olama fell to her knees. Mama, please. Get up, Egodi said. You are going to Ikenta's house. Olama's eyes widened. No, Mama. Yes. Olama, please. I am scared. Good, Egodi said. Be scared. Adaize stepped forward. Mama, please. Egodi turned angrily. You again? Adaize's tears fell freely. She will suffer there. Egodi laughed coldly. She chose it. Adaize shook her head. She does not understand. Egodi raised her hand. I said enough. Adaize stopped, her heart breaking. She could not do anything. She could not save her. She could not change her mother's mind. Later that day, Egodi packed Olama's things, roughly, without care. Carry this, she said. Olama carried the small load, her hands shaking, her body weak, her eyes full of fear. Adaize stood beside her, holding her hand. Olama, she said softly. Olama looked at her, tears flowing. I am scared. Adaize wiped her tears. It will be okay. But even as she said it, she knew it was not true. Egodi stood at the door. Go. Olama hesitated. Mama, go, Egodi shouted. Olama turned, slowly, and began to walk. Adaize watched her, her heart breaking into pieces. Olama, she called. Olama turned one last time. Their eyes met. Pain, fear, regret. Everything was there. Then Olama turned again and walked away. Adaize stood there, watching, until she disappeared. Tears rolled down her face, silently. That night, Adaize sat outside. The moon was bright, the night quiet. She hugged herself, her body shaking. She is gone, she whispered. Her voice broke. I could not help her. Tears flowed. I tried. She looked up. Chi, please protect her. Her voice was soft. Even if nobody cares, I care. She wiped her tears slowly, then closed her eyes. Because even though everything felt broken, even though she lost another piece of her heart, Adaize still held on to one thing, hope. Hope that one day, things would be better. Even if it was not today, even if it was not tomorrow, but one day. After Olama was sent away to live with Ikenta, the house became quiet. Not peaceful, just empty. There was a kind of silence that stayed in the air, a silence that carried shame, pain, and something heavy that no one wanted to talk about. Egodi did not mention Olama again, not even once. If anyone tried to talk about her, she would shut them down immediately. That girl is no longer in this house, she would say. Do not mention her name again. So, they stopped. But silence does not remove truth. It only hides it. And slowly, one by one, the truth of that family began to show. Adaize continued her life the same way. She woke up early, walked all day, went to the market, came back tired, gave everything she had, and asked for nothing. But the others, the ones Egodi loved and protected, they began to fall. The first to fall was Lotachi. Lotachi had always been rough, always quick to anger, always ready to fight. Even as a child, he would push others, shout loudly, and refuse to listen. But now, as a grown young man, his behavior became worse. He spent most of his time outside the house, with friends who were just like him. They would sit under trees, talk loudly, drink palm wine, and laugh at others. They feared no one, respected no one, and Lotachi was always in front. One afternoon, something happened. Something that would change his life forever. That day, Adaize was in the market. Egode was inside the house. Asama was sitting outside, plaiting her hair. Suddenly, loud voices were heard from the path. Angry voices, shouting, crying. Asama stood up quickly. "What is happening?" she said. Then she saw them, a group of people, coming toward the compound. In front of them was Lotachi. His clothes were dirty, his face angry. Behind him was a young woman. She was crying, holding her face, and her eye was bleeding. Asama gasped. "Lotachi, what happened?" she asked. Lotachi said nothing. He walked straight into the compound. The group followed. An older man stepped forward. His face was serious. "Who is the head of this house?" he asked. Egode came out. "I am," she said. "What is the problem?" she asked. The man pointed at Lotachi. "Your son has destroyed my daughter's life," he said. Egode frowned. "What are you talking about?" The young woman stepped forward, her face shaking. "My eye," she cried. Egode looked closely and saw it. One eye was badly injured, almost closed. Egode's heart jumped. "What happened?" she asked. The man spoke. "They were fighting," he said. "Your son hit her." Egode turned to Lotachi. "Is it true?" she asked. Lotachi shrugged. "She insulted me." "So you blinded her?" the man shouted. Lotachi said nothing. The young woman cried louder. "My eye! I cannot see!" The group murmured. "This is too much. This is wicked." Egode's face became tight. She looked at the man. "What do you want?" she asked. The man stepped forward. "Justice," he said. "What kind of justice?" Egode asked. The man looked straight at her. "Your son will marry my daughter." Silence fell. Asama gasped. "What?" she said. Egode's eyes widened. "Marry?" she repeated. "Yes," the man said. "He has destroyed her. No other man will take her now." Egode shook her head. "That is not possible." The man stepped closer. "It is possible," he said firmly. "Otherwise," he paused. "Then we will prepare for the marriage." The crowd murmured. Egode looked at Lotachi. Lotachi looked away. Egode's heart began to beat fast. She knew the truth. If the matter reached the elders, Lotachi would be punished severely. She took a deep breath, then said slowly, "All right." Lotachi turned quickly. "What?" he said. Egode looked at him. "You will marry her." Lotachi laughed. "I will not." Egode's voice became hard. "You will do it." "I said I will not," Lotachi shouted. Egode stepped forward. "You will do it, or you will face the elders." Lotachi's anger rose. "This is not fair." "Your actions are not fair," Egode shouted back. The man nodded. "We will prepare for the marriage." And just like that, Lotachi's life changed, not by choice, but by force. He was angry, very angry, but there was nothing he could do. Adaize returned home later that evening. She saw the crowd, felt the tension. "What happened?" she asked. Asama told her everything. Adaize stood still, her heart heavy. She looked at Lotachi. He looked away. For the first time, he was quiet. No shouting, no laughing, just silence. Adaize felt something. Not happiness, not satisfaction, just sadness, because she knew this was only the beginning, not the end. Days passed. Lotachi became different, still angry, but quieter. His freedom was gone, his pride broken. And then another fall came. This time, it was Asama. Asama had always been different. She loved attention, loved fine things, loved to look good. She would sit for hours plaiting her hair, adjusting her wrapper, admiring herself. But she did not like work. She did not like stress. She did not like suffering. And after everything that happened in the house, she became restless. One evening, she walked into the house with a bag. Egodi looked at her. What is this? She asked. Asama smiled. I am leaving, she said. Egodi frowned. Leaving where? To another village. For what? To live my life. Egodi stood up. What life? She asked. Asama shrugged. I am not a child anymore. Adaize stepped forward. Asama, please, she said. But Asama shook her head. I have made my decision. With who? Egodi asked. A man, Asama replied. Has he married you? Egodi asked. Asama hesitated. No. Egodi's face darkened. So you are going to live with a man who has not married you? Asama lifted her chin. Yes, Egodi shouted. You are mad. Asama smiled slightly. I am not mad. I am tired. Tired of what? Egodi asked. This house. Adaize's heart sank. Asama, please, she said. But Asama shook her head. I am going. And without looking back, she walked out. Egodi stood there, shocked, angry, speechless. Another child, gone. Days turned into weeks. The house became quieter, heavier, empty. The children Egodi protected, the children she favored, were no longer standing strong. One was forced into marriage. One ran away. One was gone with shame. And now, only Adaize remained. The same Adaize she insulted. The same Adaize she rejected. The same Adaize she called useless. Yet, she was the only one still there, still working, still caring, still standing. One evening, Egodi sat quietly, looking tired, looking frustrated. Adaize returned to the market, dropped her load, walked in, as usual. Egodi looked at her, then shook her head. Useless children, she muttered. Adaize paused. Who, Mama? She asked softly. Egodi looked at her. All of them, she said. Adaize swallowed. They are gone, Egodi continued. Useless, all of them. Adaize said nothing. Egodi pointed at her. And you? You are still here. Adaize nodded slowly. Yes, Mama. Egodi looked away, but for the first time, she did not insult her. She did not shout. She just sat there, quiet. Adaize stood for a moment, then quietly went inside to cook, to clean, to continue. Because even when everything was falling apart, even when the house was breaking, Adaize remained strong, silent, steady, because that was who she was. And even in the middle of pain, even in the middle of loss, she still chose to stand, still chose to endure, still chose to hope that one day everything would make sense.
After everything that happened, the house became quiet. Not the kind of quiet that brings peace, but the kind that carries pain. The kind that reminds you of what is missing. Olama was gone. Asama was gone. Lotachi was no longer free. And now, only two people remained in that house. Egodi and Adaize. The same Adaize that had always been there. The same Adaize that had always worked. The same Adaize that had always suffered. Now, she was the only one left to carry everything. Every morning, Adaize still woke up before the cock crowed. Nothing changed. She still fetched water, still swept the compound, still cooked, still went to the market, still came back tired, still gave everything. But now, the house felt different. There was no laughter, no noise, no arguments between the twins, no careless talk from Lotachi. Just silence and Egodi's voice. But instead of becoming softer, Egodi became worse. The anger inside her grew. Every day, she looked around and saw that her other children were gone. And instead of blaming herself, she blamed Adaize. One morning, Adaize was sweeping the compound as usual. Her movements were slow. Her body tired. Egodi stepped outside and looked around. Her face was tight. Adaize, she shouted. Adaize quickly stopped. Yes, Mama. Egodi pointed at the ground. What is this? Adaeze looked down. The compound is clean, Mama. Egodi's eyes became sharp. So you are now telling me what I can see? Adaeze shook her head quickly. No, Mama. Then why is this place still dirty? Egodi shouted. Adaeze bent down again. I will sweep it again, Mama. Egodi hissed. Useless girl. Adaeze said nothing. She just continued sweeping. Later that day, Adaeze finished cooking. She served the food carefully, placed it in front of her mother, then stood back. Egodi tasted the food, then frowned. What is this? She said. It is soup, Mama. Egodi dropped her spoon. This is not good. Adaeze stepped forward. I can add more salt. Egodi looked at her with anger. Are you telling me what to do? No, Mama. Egodi pushed the plate away. I cannot eat this rubbish. Adaeze felt her chest tighten. I will prepare another one, Mama. Egodi stood up. You are always making mistakes. I am sorry, Mama. Sorry? Egodi shouted. That is all you know to say. Adaeze lowered her head. Tears gathered in her eyes, but she did not cry. She had learned how to hold her tears. Later in the afternoon, Adaeze prepared to go to the market. She carried her goods, her body already tired. Egodi called her. Adaeze? Adaeze turned. Yes, Mama. Egodi looked at her. Do not come back with small money today. Adaeze nodded. Yes, Mama. If you come back with small money, do not enter this house, Egodi said. Adaeze swallowed. I will try, Mama. Do not try, Egodi snapped. Do it. Adaeze nodded again, then turned.
Are you ready to shape your future and make a difference through education? At Sunshine Private College, we are committed to providing exceptional tertiary education that's flexible, accessible, and tailored to your goals. We say education first. Our programs are accredited by the Namibia Qualifications Authority, NQA, and registered with the Namibia Council for Higher Education, NCHE. Enrollment for August 2026 is now open. Choose from Postgraduate Diploma in Education Secondary, 1 year Level 8, Bachelor of Education Honours in Junior Primary, 4 years Level 8, Bachelor of Education Honours in Senior Primary, 4 years Level 8, Diploma in Early Childhood Development in Junior Primary Education, 3 years Level 6, study full-time or via distance learning, block release. You choose what works for you. Call us today at 061-22-1805 or 081-288-5258 for more details. Sunshine Private College, not just about teaching, it's about inspiring your future.
Walked to the market. At the market, Adaeze worked harder than usual. She called customers louder. She stayed longer. She sold more. Her body ached, but she did not stop because she was afraid, afraid of what would happen if she failed. When the sun went down, she gathered her money, tied it carefully, and walked home. When she reached the compound, she stood at the entrance for a moment, took a deep breath, then stepped inside. Egodi was waiting. Come, she said. Adaeze walked closer. Where is the money? She handed it over. Egodi counted it, then nodded slightly. This is better, she said. Adaeze felt a small relief, but it did not last. Egodi looked at her again. Why are you standing like that? Adaeze blinked. I am tired, Mama. Egodi laughed. Tired? Yes, Mama. Egodi's voice became sharp. You are tired of what? Adaeze said nothing. Egodi stepped closer. You think you are the only one that has suffered in this world? Adaeze lowered her head. No, Mama. Then stop behaving like a weak person. Adaeze nodded. Yes, Mama. That night, Adaeze did not eat again. She lay on her mat, her stomach empty, her body weak, her heart heavy. She closed her eyes. But sleep did not come. She whispered softly, "Why is she always angry with me? I did nothing." Her voice broke. "I am trying." Tears rolled down. "I am really trying." Days passed. Egodi's anger did not reduce. In fact, it became worse. She began to say things that cut deep, things that hurt more than hunger. One afternoon, Adaeze was washing clothes. Egodi came out and stood beside her.
watching. Then she said it. You are a bastard. Adaeze froze. Her hands stopped moving. Slowly she looked up. Mama, she whispered. Egodi repeated it. You are a bastard. Adaeze's eyes filled with tears. Why are you saying that? Egodi crossed her arms. Because it is true. Adaeze shook her head. I am your daughter. Egodi laughed. My daughter? Yes, Mama. Egodi's face became cold. You are not like the others. Adaeze's heart broke. I did not choose to be born, she said softly. Egodi looked at her. Then maybe you should not have been born. Adaeze felt like the ground opened under her feet. Her chest tightened. She could not breathe well. Tears fell freely now. Mama, she cried. But Egodi turned away. I do not want to hear your voice. Adaeze sat there, holding the cloth in her hand, crying quietly. But even after that, even after those words, Adaeze did not change. She still cared. She still worked. She still loved. That evening, Egodi sat outside, looking tired, looking weak. Adaeze noticed. She walked closer. Mama, are you okay? She asked. Egodi did not answer. Adaeze touched her hand. It was warm. Mama, you are hot, she said. Egodi pulled her hand away. I am fine. No, you are not, Adaeze said softly. I will bring water. She went inside, brought water, came back. Please, drink, she said. Egodi hesitated, then took it and drank. Adaeze sat beside her. I will cook something light for you, she said. Egodi said nothing, but she did not stop her. Adaeze went inside, cooked carefully, brought the food. Mama, please eat. Egodi looked at the food, then at Adaeze. For a moment, something changed in her eyes, but it disappeared quickly. She took the food and ate. Adaeze watched her, quietly, her heart soft, her love still there. Even after everything, even after all the insults, even after being called a bastard, she still cared, because that was who she was. That evening, Adaeze lay down again, her body tired, her heart heavy. But something inside her remained, something strong, something quiet. She whispered softly, I will not become bitter. I will not become like her. Her voice was calm. I will remain good. She closed her eyes, because even though she was alone with a bitter mother, even though she was treated with pain every day, Adaeze still chose love, still chose kindness, still chose to endure. Because deep inside her heart, she still believed that one day her life would change and she would finally know peace. One day, something changed. It started quietly. At first, Adaeze noticed that her mother, Egodi, was not as strong as before. Egodi, who used to shout, walk around, and complain about everything, began to sit more. She complained of weakness. Her body looked tired. Her voice was no longer as loud. At first, Adaeze thought it was just stress. But days passed, and Egodi became worse. One morning, Adaeze woke up as usual. She finished fetching water, swept the compound, and went into the kitchen. As she was preparing food, she heard a weak voice. Adaeze, Adaeze quickly turned. Mama? She rushed into the room. Egodi was lying down. Her face looked pale. Her breathing was slow. Adiaze's heart jumped. Mama? What is it? She asked, kneeling beside her. Egodi looked at her weakly. My body. I am not feeling strong. Adaeze touched her forehead. It was hot. Very hot. Mama, you are burning, she said. Egodi closed her eyes. I don't know what is happening to me. Adaeze stood up quickly. I will get water, she said. She ran outside, brought water, came back, carefully lifted her mother's head. Mama, drink.
Egudi drank slowly. Her hands were shaking. Adiaze's heart was beating fast. Fear had entered her. That same day, Adiaze did not go to the market. For the first time in a long time, she stayed back to take care of her mother. She prepared light food, fed her, wiped her body, sat beside her, watched her closely. That night, Adiaze did not sleep. She stayed awake, looking at her mother, listening to her breathing. Whenever Egudi moved, Adiaze would wake immediately. "Mama, are you okay?" "Yes," Egudi would reply weakly. Days passed. Egudi's condition became worse. She could no longer stand properly. She could no longer shout. She could no longer do anything. The same woman who once controlled the house now lay helpless, and the only person beside her was Adiaze. The same Adiaze she insulted, the same Adiaze she called a bastard, the same Adiaze she treated like nothing. But Adiaze did not remember any of that. She did not complain. She did not bring up the past. She only did one thing. She cared. Every morning, she cleaned her mother, changed her wrapper, fed her, gave her water, talked to her gently. "Mama, you will be fine," she would say. Even when she was not sure, even when her own heart was afraid. One evening, Egudi looked at Adiaze for a long time without speaking. Adiaze noticed. "Mama, why are you looking at me like that?" she asked softly. Egudi opened her mouth, then closed it again. She turned her face away. "Nothing," she said. But inside her heart, something was happening. Something she had buried for years. Something she had refused to face. But now, it was coming out. That night, Egudi could not sleep. She kept turning, breathing heavily. Adiaze sat beside her. "Mama, are you in pain?" she asked. Egudi nodded slightly. Adiaze held her hand. "I am here," she said. Egudi looked at her again, her eyes filled with something new, something soft, something like regret. The next morning, Egudi spoke, her voice weak. "Adiaze." "Yes, Mama?" "Call them." "Who, Mama?" "Your siblings." Adiaze paused. "All of them?" "Yes." Adiaze nodded. "I will go and call them." That same day, Adiaze went out. She moved from place to place, looking for them. She found Lotachi. He was with his wife. She told him, "Mama is very sick. She wants to see you." Lotachi's face changed. "I will come," he said. She went to find Asama. After asking around, she found her in another village. "Asama, Mama is sick." Asama looked surprised. "Is it serious?" "Yes." Asama nodded. "I will come." Then, Adiaze went to where Olama was staying, with Ikenta. When Olama saw her, she froze. "Adiaze, Mama is calling you." Adiaze's eyes filled with tears. "I will come." By evening, they were all in the house. All of them, together again. But not in joy, in fear, in silence. Egudi lay on her mat, weak, barely moving. She opened her eyes slowly and saw them, all her children. Tears filled her eyes. "You have come," she said weakly. "Yes, Mama," they answered. She looked at each one of them. Then her eyes stopped at Adiaze and stayed there for a long time. Then she spoke. "There is something I must say." They all listened, silently, carefully. Egudi took a deep breath, then began. "Adiaze." "Yes, Mama." "You are my daughter." Adiaze nodded. Yes, Mama, Egodi continued. But, she paused. Tears filled her eyes. You are not Okeke's child. Silence. The air became still. No one moved. No one spoke. Adiaze's heart stopped for a moment. What? She whispered. Egodi's voice shook. I had you before I married Okeke. Adiaze's eyes widened. Her hands began to shake. I don't understand. Egodi closed her eyes, then opened them again. It was not by choice. Her voice broke. I was forced. Tears rolled down her face. I was raped. The word hung in the air. Heavy. Painful. Real. Adiaze felt her chest tighten. Her breath became difficult. Egodi continued. I did not want it, but it happened. I became pregnant, and I had you. Tears flowed freely now. After that, I married Okeke. He accepted you. He loved you. But me, she paused, her voice breaking. I never healed. Adiaze looked at her, her eyes filled with pain, filled with confusion, filled with heartbreak. You called me a bastard, Egodi cried. I was wrong. You are not. You are my daughter. Adiaze shook her head slowly, tears streaming down her face. I loved you, she cried. I cared for you. I did everything. And you hated me. Egodi reached out weakly. I am sorry. I am so sorry. Adiaze looked at her, her eyes full of pain, full of confusion, full of heartbreak. You called me a bastard, Egodi cried. I was wrong. You are not. You are my daughter. Adiaze shook her head slowly. I suffered, she cried. I suffered so much. Egodi nodded. I know. And I regret it. I regret everything. She looked at the others. And you, she said, I poisoned your minds. I made you hate her for nothing. The siblings lowered their heads. Shame filled their hearts. Egodi turned back to Adiaze. Please forgive me. Adiaze stood there, silent, broken. But inside her, something moved. Not anger, not hate. Something else. Something soft. She stepped closer, kneeling beside her mother, her voice shaking. Mama, Egodi looked at her. I forgive you. Egodi cried harder. Thank you. Adiaze held her hand, tears still falling. Because even though the truth came late, even though the pain was deep, Adiaze chose something different. She chose forgiveness.
The room was silent, heavy. No one spoke. No one moved. Only the sound of quiet crying could be heard. Egodi lay on the mat, weak and breathing slowly. Her eyes were still open, but her strength was fading. Adaize knelt beside her, holding her hand. Tears still flowed down her face, but her heart had become calm. Not because the pain was gone, but because the truth had finally been spoken. Behind her, her siblings stood. Lotachi, Asama, Olama, all of them frozen, all of them ashamed, all of them seeing Adaize for the first time, not as a servant, not as someone to insult, but as a human being, a sister, a person who had suffered because of them. Olama was the first to move. Slowly, she stepped forward, her legs shaking, her eyes full of tears. Adaize, she called softly. Adaize turned slightly. Olama fell to her knees. I am sorry, she cried. Her voice broke.
I am so sorry. Adaeze looked at her. Olama continued. I lied against you. I caused your pain. I made Mama hate you more. I was wicked. She covered her face. I am sorry. Adaeze said nothing. Her heart was heavy, but she listened. Asama stepped forward next. Tears filled her eyes. Adaeze, she knelt beside Olama. I followed Mama. I did not think for myself. I insulted you. I laughed at you. I treated you like nothing. Her voice shook. But you were always there for us, she cried. I am sorry. Lotachi stood still. He did not move at first, but slowly he stepped forward, his face serious, his eyes filled with regret. Adaeze, his voice was low, I chased away men that came for you. I threatened them. I insulted you. He paused. I did not know, but that is not an excuse. He looked at her. I am sorry. The room became quiet again. All of them were on their knees now, facing Adaeze, crying, begging. Adaeze looked at them, one by one. Her heart remembered everything. The hunger, the insults, the pain, the loneliness, the rejection, everything. But then she also remembered something else. Her mother's words, "You did nothing wrong." Those words stayed in her heart. She took a deep breath, then spoke, her voice soft. "You hurt me." They all lowered their heads. "But I forgive you." They looked up, surprised, relieved, emotional. Adaeze continued, "We were all hurt. We were all broken. But we can still choose to be better." Olama cried harder. Asama nodded through tears. Lotachi swallowed deeply. For the first time in their lives, they felt something real. Not pride, not anger, but humility, regret, and love. Egodi, lying on the mat, watched everything. Tears rolled down her face. She had lived wrongly. She had caused pain. But now she was seeing something she never thought she would see. Her children, united, through truth, through forgiveness, through pain. She tried to speak. "My children." They all turned to her. She looked at them. "I am sorry." They moved closer. "Forgive me." "Mama," they cried. Egodi closed her eyes briefly, then opened them again. "I was blind. I let my pain destroy you." She looked at Adaeze. "You are a good daughter." Adaeze held her hand tighter. "Mama." Egodi smiled weakly. Then her body shook slightly. Her breathing became heavier. Adaeze noticed immediately. "Mama," she called. Egodi did not answer. Her eyes were closing. "Mama," Adaeze called again. Panic entered the room. Lotachi stepped forward. "What is happening?" "She is not responding," Adaeze said. Asama cried. Olama held her chest. "What do we do?" Adaeze stood up quickly. "We have to take her to the herbalist." Lotachi nodded. "Yes." They moved fast. They lifted Egodi carefully, carried her outside. The night was falling. The air was cold, but they did not stop. They walked quickly, almost running, their hearts beating fast, their minds filled with fear. When they reached the herbalist's place, they called out, "Please, help us!" The herbalist came out, an old man, calm, wise. He looked at Egodi, then nodded, "Bring her inside." They carried her in, laid her down. The herbalist began his work. He checked her, gave her herbs, spoke softly. The children waited, outside, sitting on the ground, silent, fearful. Time passed, slowly, painfully. No one spoke, no one moved. After some time, the herbalist came out. They all stood up quickly. "How is she?" Adaeze asked. The herbalist looked at them, then sighed. "I tried, but her time has come." Silence, heavy silence. Olama began to cry loudly. "No!" Asama held her.
Lotachi looked away, his jaw tight. Adaeze stood still, her body frozen. No, she whispered. The herbalist spoke gently. She is gone. The words hit them like a storm. Egudi was gone. Adaeze fell to her knees. Tears flowed freely. Mama, she cried. Her voice broke. I forgive you. I forgive you. The others cried too, loudly, openly. The night carried their pain, their regret, their loss. The next day, they brought Egudi home. The village gathered. People came. Women cried. Men spoke quietly. The burial was prepared. Adaeze moved like a shadow, silent, calm, but inside she was breaking. She prepared everything, organized everything, did everything, just like she always had. But this time, it was different. This time, it was her mother. The burial took place. The ground was opened. Egudi was laid to rest. The earth covered her. Slowly, finally, and just like that, she was gone. Forever. After the burial, the house became empty again. But this time, it was different. This was not the silence of fear or pain. This was the silence of realization. The siblings sat together, for the first time, without anger, without pride, without hatred, just quiet. Lotachi spoke first. We were wrong. Asama agreed. Yes. Olama wiped her tears. We did not see. Adaeze sat quietly, listening. Lotachi looked at her, her eyes calm. We all made mistakes, she said. But now we know better. They nodded, slowly. Because even though they had lost their mother, they had found something else. Truth, understanding, and a chance to change. The house was broken, yes, but it was also awakened. After the burial of their mother, the house felt different. Not just quiet, not just empty, but open. It was as if something heavy had been lifted from the air. For many years, that house had been filled with anger, shouting, and pain. Now, there was silence. But this silence was not frightening. It was calm. It was the beginning of something new. That evening, all the siblings sat together in the compound, the same place where they once argued, the same place where Adaeze had been insulted many times. But now, everything had changed. No one shouted, no one insulted, no one fought. They just sat quietly, thinking, remembering, feeling. Adaeze sat in the middle, calm, her face soft, her eyes tired but peaceful. Lotachi sat on one side, his wife beside him. Asama sat quietly, her head lowered. Olama sat with her hands wrapped around herself, like someone seeking comfort. For a long time, no one spoke. Then Adaeze finally broke the silence. Her voice was gentle. My brothers, my sisters, they all looked at her. She continued, we have lost our mother. Their eyes filled with tears again. But before she left, she spoke the truth. They nodded slowly. Adaeze took a deep breath. We cannot change the past. Silence. But we can choose how we live now. Lotachi nodded. Asama wiped her eyes. Olama looked up. Adaeze looked at each of them. We have all made mistakes, she said. But we can become better. Her voice was firm now. We must become better. Lotachi spoke. How? Adaeze turned to him. By working, by being responsible, by treating each other with respect. Asama spoke softly. I don't know how to start. Adaeze smiled gently. We will start together. Olama's voice trembled. I want to come back home. All eyes turned to her. She swallowed hard. Ikenta does not care about me. Tears filled her eyes. He only cares about women. Her voice broke. I was wrong. Adaeze looked at her, her heart soft. You can come back, she said. Olamma burst into tears. Thank you. Adaeze reached out and held her hand. You are my sister. Asama spoke next. I also want to come back, she said quietly. The man I went to meet, she paused. He has not married me. I have no respect there. Adaeze nodded. You can come back too. Asama began to cry. Thank you. Lotachi cleared his throat. I have not been a good person, he said. He looked at his wife. I have been angry. I have been violent. His wife looked at him, her eyes soft. But I want to change. Adaeze nodded. You will change. Lotachi took his wife's hand. We will live in peace, he said. His wife smiled. I am ready. Adaeze looked at all of them, her heart full. This is how we begin again, she said. From that day, things started to change, slowly but surely. Adaeze did not force anyone. She did not shout. She did not command. She guided, with patience, with wisdom, with love. The next morning, she woke up early, as usual, but this time, she was not alone. As she stepped outside, she saw Olamma already sweeping. Adaeze paused, surprised. Olamma looked at her. I woke up early. I want to help. Adaeze smiled. Thank you. Asama came out next. I will fetch water, she said. Adaeze nodded. Lotachi came out later. I will go to the farm, he said. Adaeze looked at him. That is good. His wife stood beside him. I will cook, she added. Adaeze's heart felt light. For the first time, she was not carrying everything alone. Days passed. They walked together. They ate together. They spoke kindly to each other. There were still small disagreements, but they did not fight. They talked. They listened. They learned. Adaeze showed them how to trade in the market, how to manage money, how to save, how to respect others. She taught them patiently, without anger, without pride. And slowly, they changed. Olamma became stronger. She worked hard. She stopped depending on others. Asama became more careful. She respected herself. She focused on building a better life. Lotachi became calmer. He controlled his anger. He treated his wife with kindness. The house became alive again, but this time with peace, not pain. And Adaeze, for the first time in her life, started to rest. Not fully, but little by little. One day, something unexpected happened. Adaeze went to the market as usual. She arranged her goods, sat quietly, waiting for customers. A man approached. He was tall, calm, well-dressed, but simple. His face kind. Good afternoon, he said. Adaeze looked up. Good afternoon, she replied. He smiled. I want to buy from you. Adaeze nodded. What do you need? He pointed at her goods. She served him, carefully. He watched her. The way she spoke, the way she handled things, the way she smiled softly. You are hardworking, he said. Adaeze looked at him. It is what I know, she replied. He nodded. I have been watching you for some time. Adaeze was surprised. Why? He smiled. Because you are different. Adaeze said nothing. The man continued. My name is Obinna. Adaeze nodded. I am Adaeze. Obinna smiled. I know. Adaeze blinked. You know? Yes, he said. People talk about you. Adaeze felt shy. What do they say? They say you are strong. They say you are kind. They say you have suffered, but you still have a good heart. Adaeze looked down. She did not know what to say. Obinna spoke again. I would like to know you better. Adaeze looked up slowly, her heart beating. She hesitated. Obinna noted. I am not here to hurt you, he said gently. I am a farmer. I work hard. I respect people. Adaeze studied his face. She saw no pride, no arrogance, just sincerity. I am not ready for pain, she said softly. Obinna nodded. I understand. I will not rush you. I will wait. Days passed. Obinna continued to visit. Not every day, but often. He spoke kindly. He respected her space. He did not force anything. Slowly, Adaeze began to trust him. She smiled more. She spoke more.
She laughed. For the first time in a long time, she felt something new. Peace. One evening, Obinna came to her house with his family. Respectfully, properly, Lotachi welcomed them. Asama and Olama prepared food. They all sat together. Obinna spoke. I have come for Adaize. The room was quiet. Lotachi looked at Adaize. Adaize looked down, her heart full. Lotachi nodded. If she agrees. Adaize lifted her head slowly. She looked at Obinna. His eyes were calm, honest, kind. She smiled softly. I agree. Tears filled her sibling's eyes, not of pain, but of joy. The marriage preparations began. Simple, peaceful, full of love. On the day of the marriage, Adaize stood beautifully, dressed well, smiling, her heart light, her past behind her, her future ahead. Her siblings stood beside her, proud, happy, grateful. Lotachi whispered, "You deserve this." Asama held her hand, "You are our strength." Olama hugged her, "Thank you for not giving up on us." Adaize smiled, "I love you all." She left with Obinna to her new home, a home of peace, a home of respect, a home of love. And even after she left, she did not forget her family. She visited them, guided them, supported them, and they continued to grow, together, as a family, as one. And so, the story ended, not with pain, not with tears, but with healing, with forgiveness, with a new beginning, because Adaize chose something powerful. She chose love. She chose peace. She chose forgiveness. And in doing that, she changed everything. Final message of the story. This story teaches that pain does not define your destiny. Family can wound, but healing is possible. True strength is forgiveness. And no matter how long suffering lasts, joy will come.
Joy will come in the morning.
Loveth staggered forward, her baby tied to her back, a heavy bundle of firewood shaking on her head. Her legs wobbled, her tears mixed with sweat. Every step felt like punishment. When she pushed the hut door open, Daniel, her own husband, was kissing another woman. Her breath shattered. Before she could even step back, his fingers wrapped around her neck, squeezing brutally. Sit back as we unveil this shocking story of betrayal, domestic cruelty, and a twist even karma could not ignore. Loveth had already been awake for 2 hours. She rose before the sun had the courage to show its face. She rose before the birds found their voices. She rose in the dark, in the quiet, in the loneliness that had become her closest companion in 6 years of marriage. She tied Destiny, her 18-month-old daughter, to her back with a faded wrapper, and she began her day the same way she had begun every day since she moved into Daniel's compound as a new bride, with nothing but her own 2 hands and whatever strength God had left in her body. She swept the compound. She fetched water from the stream 3 compounds away. She lit the firewood and boiled water for the morning meal. She ground pepper by hand on the stone slab outside the kitchen because the blender Daniel had promised to buy 2 years ago had never arrived. She fed Destiny mashed yam and breast milk. She packed the remaining firewood she had gathered the previous day into a bundle, balanced it on her head, and set off toward the market before the heat of the day could slow her steps. All this before 7 in the morning. Daniel was still sleeping. This was the life that Loveth had accepted, not because she was weak, but because she had been taught since childhood that a good wife endures. Her mother had endured. Her grandmother had endured. The women of her family wore endurance like a badge of honor, and nobody had ever sat Loveth down to explain the difference between endurance and suffering. Nobody had told her that there was a line, a very important line, between staying strong inside a difficult marriage and slowly allowing yourself to be destroyed inside one. So Loveth endured. She was 26 years old, but her eyes carried the weight of a woman who had lived twice that. Her hands were rough from farm work and firewood gathering. Her feet were calloused from years of walking unpaved roads. But her face, was still soft, still beautiful in the way that hardship cannot always take away. She had a gentleness about her that made people want to be near her, a kind of warmth that radiated without effort. She smiled easily, though the smiles rarely reached her eyes any more. Daniel, her husband, was 31. He had been charming once, or at least he had known how to appear charming when he wanted something. He had come to her father's house with palm wine and smooth words, and Loveth had believed him when he said he would take care of her. She had believed the promises. She had said yes. But the man who showed up after the wedding was a different Daniel entirely. This Daniel did not go to farm with any consistency. He woke up late, spent his afternoons with friends who had too much time and too little responsibility, and came home in the evenings, smelling of local gin and cigarette smoke. He contributed almost nothing to the household. When Loveth asked him about money for food or for Destiny's needs, he would either wave her off impatiently or erupt into an argument that always somehow ended with her apologizing. He had a temper like a bushfire, sudden, consuming, and indiscriminate. The first time he raised his hand to her, they had been married only 4 months. He had come home drunk, and she had made the mistake of asking him where he had been. The slap landed so fast that she did not even see it coming. She stood there stunned, her cheek burning, her eyes wide with disbelief, and Daniel had looked at her with something cold and dismissive in his gaze before walking past her into the bedroom. He had not apologized. Not that night. Not ever. Loveth had cried alone in the kitchen while her food went cold on the fire, and then she had told herself, it was the drink. He was not himself. It would not happen again. But it happened again and again. And the village knew. Of course the village knew. In Oke-Ilu, walls were thin and voices carried, and neighbors had ears even when they pretended not to. People whispered about Loveth's situation in low voices at the stream and the market. Some pitied her. Some said she must have done something to deserve it. Some said nothing at all, because getting involved in another person's marriage was considered dangerous business. One woman, however, watched more carefully than the rest. Her name was Mama Blossom. She was a widow in her late 60s who lived in the compound directly behind Daniel's fence. She had seen 4 decades of village life, and she had learned to read people the way some women read the sky for rain. She saw Loveth leave early every morning. She saw Daniel stumble in late at night. She heard the shouting through the thin walls on the nights when things were bad. And she said nothing, not yet, but she watched, and she remembered, and she prayed in her quiet way for the young woman who carried too much on her back. Destiny? The baby girl had no idea what any of it meant. She only knew the warmth of her mother's back, the rhythm of her mother's stride, the sound of her mother's voice humming soft songs in the dark. She reached her tiny hand up sometimes and patted Loveth's shoulder as if she somehow understood. And Loveth would reach back and hold those small fingers and remind herself, this child, this is why I keep going. It was in the fifth year of their marriage that Loveth first began to notice the change. Daniel had always been careless with money, or rather, careless with the idea that household needs required money. But now he was gone more. He stopped coming home for dinner most nights. When he did come home, he was restless, distracted, checking something in his pocket, or walking outside to speak in low voices on his phone. He stopped giving Loveth money for food altogether. Not that he had ever been consistent, but before he would toss her a few notes when she pushed hard enough. Now there was nothing. When she asked, he snapped, "Do you think money grows in my pocket? Go and find your own money." And he would walk away, while Destiny sat on the mat, watching with her big, curious eyes, too young to understand, but old enough to feel the tension that lived in every corner of their home. Loveth began to carry extra loads. She went to the farm at dawn, and the market by morning. She sold firewood, she sold vegetables, she dried fish, and sold that too. Every single naira she made went into feeding herself and her daughter, because Daniel had essentially removed himself from the financial life of the household while remaining physically present enough to demand meals and obedience. Then the gifts started appearing. She first noticed when she found a small wrapper of perfume in his trouser pocket while doing laundry. Expensive perfume, the kind sold in glass bottles at the big shop in the next town. The kind that Loveth had never owned a single drop of in her entire life. She held it for a long moment, turning it in her palm.
International Cyber Security Conference and Exhibition Ikondo epangero mahangano gopa umwene, u ministeri wepangero ni ikondo ya yoroka no handimwe, onetamuisa Mujoroke comtumba omtitatu watumburwa mete tekero. Esikwamirongo mbalinaga alisigombalinaga nega piriri, mavigali mirongo mbalinaga mano. Ejaroko Arembush Travel Lodge, Movenduka. Oshi parashi kundathanwa okwanjaga nekuyerere kombinga ukoshoki wopongomba, ano saiba hejin. Kena una okuironge kidira omashongo okomarungura. No marongo kehopopeko jerongizo jomarungura nairu inji. Koneka, omahangano ohandimwe ni kondo. Mbokata mkatuma akaliripo ya konda pantu ya tano otamukapewa ompito yomtu gumwe awedhu wapo hasho ashikeshoka pethimbo yomtumba ogotungoka otakukakara o VIP cyber gala dina nuyere lounji wa maisha angizo no mapurapuro kwatathana nayo konoraje tatu imwe onda tu ya tano omgoigeali nenge ko email info@dstech.com.na nenge utarelepo epanja jao jopa ungomba ko www.dstech.com .na. Namibia International Cyber Security Conference and Exhibition, Securing Namibia Digital Future.
Before placing it quietly back in his pocket, a week later she saw him from across the market, laughing. He was with a woman young, dressed well, her hair done in the kind of expensive style that took hours and money. He was carrying a bag of groceries. He was smiling the way he had smiled at Loveth once, long ago, when the world was still new and his promises were still fresh. Loveth stood still among the crowd and watched. Her chest tightened, her throat closed. She turned and walked home because she could not trust what her face was doing. That evening she put his food on the table and said nothing. He ate. He said nothing either. The village was already talking. Market women who saw Loveth every morning exchanged glances when Daniel's name came up. "That man and that Ola woman," they said, keeping their voices just below a whisper. "He bought her Ankara. He paid for her hair. and his wife is carrying firewood like a widow. Ola was her name. Ola, who knew very well that Daniel was married. Ola, who did not care, or perhaps enjoyed the power of taking what belonged to someone else. She was not a young girl making an innocent mistake. She was a grown woman who had made a deliberate choice, and she encouraged Daniel in all the ways that a man like him did not need encouraging. She laughed at his stories about Loveth. She called her that village woman. She told Daniel he deserved better, and Daniel, whose pride was already enormous, swallowed every word like water. Loveth confronted him one evening in their bedroom. She had spent days building up the courage. She had rehearsed what she would say. She had told herself to stay calm, to speak from her heart, to appeal to whatever remained of the man she had married. Daniel, she said, I know there is another woman. He turned from the window where he had been standing and looked at her with an expression so cold it could have chilled water. What did you say? I saw you in the market. With her, I know what is happening. He laughed. It was not a warm laugh. It was the kind of laugh that was meant to diminish, to reduce, to make the other person feel foolish for speaking at all. You saw me talking to someone and you come here with your accusations? What is wrong with you? Daniel, I am not accusing. I am asking you. Please, we have a child. We have a home. Whatever is happening, we can. The slap cut her words off. She stumbled backward, her hand flying to her cheek, her eyes stinging not only from the impact, but from the humiliation of it, the sheer, casual brutality of a man who had decided that her speaking was itself an offence. I am the man of this house, he said, his voice low and hard. I do what I want, and you will do what you are told. Do you understand me? She said, nothing. Do you understand me? Yes, she whispered. He left the room. She sat on the edge of the bed, holding her face, listening to Destiny's quiet breathing from the mat on the floor. And something inside Loveth, something that had been trying for a long time to stay alive, went very, very quiet. After that night, she changed. Not in a way that people would immediately notice. She still woke early, she still carried firewood, she still cooked and cleaned and held her daughter close. But inside, a rearrangement was happening. A quiet and decisive restructuring of what she believed about her own life. She began to save money. Not dramatically, not in large amounts. She kept a small tin behind the clay pot in the kitchen corner, underneath a folded piece of old cloth. Every day, she counted what she earned and set aside a portion, sometimes just 40 naira, sometimes 100 if she had sold well. She never touched it. She did not even let herself think too clearly about what it was for. She only knew that it had to exist, that she had to have something that was only hers. Mama Blossom noticed the change in Loveth's eyes one morning at the well. You are tired, the old woman said, not as a question, but as a fact spoken gently. Loveth almost denied it. Then she looked at Mama Blossom's face and could not find the energy to pretend. Yes, Mama, she said. I am very tired. Mama Blossom filled her bucket in silence. Then she said, Endurance is good, my daughter, but suffering without end is not marriage. It is slavery. There is a difference. When you are ready to know that difference, you will know what to do. she carried her bucket away and left Loveth standing at the well with those words settling into her chest, like seeds finding soil. The day it happened, Loveth had been to the forest edge before sunrise to gather firewood. It was a long walk and a heavy load, and she had Destiny on her back the whole way. The baby had been fussing in the morning, a little fever from the Harmattan air, and Loveth had given her some warm water and tied her securely and walked anyway, because there was no one else to watch the child and no one else to gather the wood, and the market waited for no one. By the time she was walking back toward the compound, the sun was fully awake, and the load on her head was heavier than usual. Her legs shook with every step. The sweat ran down her neck and soaked the collar of her blouse. Destiny had fallen asleep on her back, her small head lolling to one side, her tiny hands relaxed and still. Loveth thought about what she would cook. She thought about the money she had saved, now close to 12,000 naira after many months. She thought about Destiny's cough from the previous week. She thought about nothing in particular. She was too tired to think clearly. She was simply moving, the way an animal follows a path, because stopping was not an option. She pushed open the door of their hut with her shoulder, stepping sideways to manage the bundle of wood. And she saw them, Daniel and Ola, together in Loveth's own home, on the mat where Loveth slept, not even shameful about it, not even startled, as if they had been so comfortable that the thought of being caught had never entered their minds. The bundle of wood slipped from Loveth's head and crashed to the ground. She barely heard it. The room seemed to tilt around her. Destiny stirred on her back and made a small sound. "Daniel," she whispered. Her voice came out like something torn. "Why would you do this to me?" What happened next happened so fast that her mind could not fully record it in order. Daniel was on his feet. His face was not ashamed. His face was furious, furious at her, as if she were the one who had done something wrong. He crossed the room in three steps, and his hand wrapped around her throat before she could even register what was happening. The wall met her back with a crash that rattled her teeth. His grip tightened. Her hands flew up instinctively, clawing at his fingers. But he was stronger, and the angle was wrong, and the bundle of firewood was still in the doorway, and her legs were already shaking from the long walk. "You should have minded your business." His voice was like thunder directly above her head. His eyes were not the eyes of a husband. They were the eyes of something she did not recognize, something cornered and vicious and completely without remorse. She kicked, she scratched, her lungs screamed for air. The edges of her vision began to blur. And then Destiny, little Destiny, on her back, jolted awake by the impact and the noise, and the terror moving through her mother's body like electricity, began to cry. Not a soft cry, a loud, shattering, infant scream that split the air of the small hut and flew out through the open door and across the compound and into the street beyond. Something changed. Perhaps it was the cry. Perhaps it was the sound of running feet outside. Perhaps Daniel himself, somewhere beneath his rage, heard the child, and something in him faltered. His grip loosened just for a moment, and Loveth twisted away, gasping, one hand braced against the wall, her breath coming back in ragged, desperate pulls. Mama Blossom appeared in the doorway. Behind her, two other neighbors. Their faces said everything. Daniel stepped back. He looked at his hands. Then he looked at Loveth, crumpled against the wall, her neck already showing the shadow of his fingers, her baby screaming on her back, and something passed across his face. Not guilt, not remorse, something more like calculation. The recognition that there were witnesses now. Ola had already gathered herself and slipped past everyone, not meeting anyone's eyes, disappearing down the road without looking back. "It is not what you think," Daniel said to the gathered neighbors. His voice was almost calm. She fell. Nobody in the doorway said a word. But Mama Blossom looked at Loveth with eyes that held an entire conversation, and Loveth, still breathing in shallow gasps, understood every word of it. After that day, the house became something else entirely. Loveth moved through it like a woman learning to walk again. Her neck was bruised for 2 weeks. She told no one in her family. Her mother was old and her brothers were far away. And what would she say? That the man they had celebrated at the wedding, the man who had drunk palm wine with her father, had held her by the throat in their home while her daughter screamed. She couldn't say it. Not yet. Daniel did not apologize. He did not mention what had happened. Within 2 days, he was behaving as though that afternoon had not occurred, sitting in the compound, talking on his phone, eating the food Loveth cooked without comment, treating her with the particular contempt of a man who knows he has gone too far and has decided that the best response is to act as if he has not. Ola continued to come around, more boldly now. She would stand at the compound entrance and call out for Daniel, and he would go to her without even looking in Loveth's direction. He had stopped pretending. Loveth's body healed faster than her mind. She went back to the farm, back to the market, back to the daily, punishing routine that had become her entire world. But something was different now. The thing that had gone quiet inside her after the first slap years ago, it was awake again, and it was not speaking in the language of endurance anymore. She had almost died. This was the truth she let herself sit with for the first time. Not he lost his temper, not he didn't mean it. She had almost died. Her daughter had been on her back while her father's hands were around her mother's throat. Destiny had screamed because her small body understood, even without words, that something was very, very wrong. Loveth began to think differently. She thought about the 12,000 naira in the tin. She thought about her cousin in Ibadan, who had once offered her a place to stay if she ever needed it. She thought about the small trade in smoked fish that the market women had taught her. The business she could build if she had time and space and safety to build it. She thought about destiny, about what destiny would learn if she grew up watching her mother be treated this way, about what kind of woman her daughter would become if this was the only love she ever saw modeled. She thought about Mama Blossom's words. Suffering without end is not marriage. It is slavery. One afternoon, while Daniel was away and the compound was quiet, Daniel's friend Emeka came to greet him and ended up speaking to Loveth at the gate for a moment. Emeka was not a bad man, simply one of those men who attach themselves to stronger personalities without thinking too hard about what those personalities were doing. He laughed awkwardly and said, "You know, Daniel, he is just stubborn, but he knows you have no place to go. He always says that. Where will she go? She has nothing." He said it as if it were a comfort, as if the certainty of her entrapment was meant to make her feel secure. Loveth smiled at him politely. Inside, something hardened like iron cooling in water. Where will she go? She has nothing. That night, lying on the mat beside Destiny, Listening to the sound of Daniel snoring from across the room, Loveth stared at the ceiling of their hut for a long time. She counted what she had. She thought about what she needed. She prayed in the way she had always prayed, not loudly, not with performance, but deep in her chest, the kind of prayer that is more feeling than word. God, if you can see me, show me a way. It happened on a Tuesday. The market day, Loveth had gone to sell her firewood and some dried fish she had prepared. She was packing up her stall in the late afternoon when she heard a commotion nearby. She looked up and saw Daniel in the middle of the road shouting at a young man who had apparently bumped his bicycle into Daniel's path. Within seconds, Daniel had grabbed the young man and shoved him to the ground, and the crowd that gathered was not on Daniel's side. People were pointing. People were shaking their heads. "That man has no sense," someone near Loveth muttered. "He does this everywhere, bullying people, beating his wife at home. Nobody has told him that life will answer him." Daniel looked up and saw Loveth watching from among the crowd. He did not stop. He straightened his shirt, stared her down, and walked away, daring her to react, daring her to say anything. Loveth gathered her things. She picked up Destiny. She walked home. That evening, she cooked. She set his food on the table. She bathed Destiny and dressed her in her best cloth. Then she sat in the compound until it was dark and quiet. Daniel came in around 9. He saw his food. He sat and ate without speaking to her. He went inside and fell asleep. At midnight, when his breathing was steady and the compound was perfectly still, Loveth rose. She moved like water, without sound, without rushing. She took the tin from behind the clay pot. She took Destiny's small bag that she had packed carefully 2 days before. She took 2 changes of clothes for herself. She took her small Bible. She took Destiny. She stood at the door of the room for 1 moment, looking at Daniel's sleeping form. He looked smaller in sleep, less dangerous. She wondered for a moment if she was making a mistake, if this man who lay sleeping could possibly be the same man who had wrapped his hands around her throat. And then she touched her neck, where the bruise had only fully faded a week ago, and she had her answer. She turned and walked out. She did not run. She walked steadily, deliberately, 1 foot in front of the other, down the quiet road, past Mama Blossom's compound, under the big Iroko tree at the village entrance, and onto the main road where the night lorry to Ibadan passed at 1 in the morning. She did not look back. Mama Blossom, sitting outside on her veranda, as she sometimes did on warm nights, watched Loveth pass with the sleeping baby on her back and the small bag in her hand. The old woman said nothing, but she raised her hand in the darkness, a gesture of blessing, of release, of a prayer sent silently after a woman who had finally found the courage to choose her own life. Her cousin Grace received her in Ibadan at 4 in the morning without a single word of complaint. She opened the door, took 1 look at Loveth's face, and said, "Come inside." She heated soup. She made a bed for Destiny. She sat with Loveth while she ate, and she did not ask questions until Loveth was ready to answer them. It took 3 weeks before Loveth stopped waking in the night, expecting to hear Daniel's voice, but she did stop. Gradually, the way a wound that has been allowed to breathe begins very slowly to close. She started small. Grace's neighbour was a fish trader who needed help at the market on weekends, and Lover threw herself into the work with the same ferocious energy she had always had, except now the fruit of that energy went directly into her own hands. She learned quickly. She remembered everything. She had a way with customers, a warmth, and an honesty that made people come back. Within 6 months, she had her own small stall at the Ibadan Central Market. Within a year, she had expanded to dried fish, smoked catfish, palm oil, and crayfish. She was known. She was trusted. People sought her out specifically. Not just for the quality of her goods, but for the way she dealt fairly, without short measuring, without the inflated prices that many traders used. Destiny grew. She walked. She talked. She laughed. She sat behind the stall on market days and played with bottle caps and learned to count by watching her mother count money. She was healthy and bright and secure in the way that children are secure when they know they are loved completely. Loveth enrolled in an adult business training class offered at the community center on Wednesday evenings. She learned about records, accounting, inventory, supplier negotiations, things she had never known she could learn, things that opened her mind like a door swinging inward. By the third year in Ibadan, she had opened a small shop. By the fifth year, the shop had become a proper store, stocked, clean, staffed by two young women she employed from the market. She built it the way she had built everything in her life. Quietly, stubbornly, one day at a time, with hands that had always known how to work and a spirit that had refused, despite everything, to be permanently broken. She still prayed. She still sang. She still sometimes stood at the window in the early morning, before the city came fully awake, and felt the old ache of everything she had lost and endured. But the ache was no longer in charge. It was simply part of her, a scar that reminded her of what she had survived, not a wound that kept reopening. She did not return to Okeilu. She sent word through Grace's network that she and Destiny were safe, and she left it at that. She had forgiven Daniel in the way that one forgives in order to set oneself free, not with warmth, not with the desire to see him again, but with the deliberate unclenching of the fist that anger kept closed inside her chest. She moved forward. She did not look back. In Okeilu, the absence of Loveth was noticed in stages. First, there was confusion. Nobody believed she had truly gone. Then there was talk. Then Daniel began telling people she had run away, as if this was something shameful about her, rather than something that reflected anything about him. He told people she was ungrateful, that he had provided for her, that she had abandoned her husband without cause. The village listened. But the village also had eyes. They had seen the bruises. They had heard the shouting. They knew who carried firewood and who stayed in bed. And Ola, who had seemed so certain and so bold when Loveth was present, became noticeably less certain and less bold now that the wife was gone. The novelty of Daniel, the excitement of the forbidden, faded quickly when he was simply a man with an empty house and a bad temper and no one to clean up after him. Within 8 months, Ola had moved on to other arrangements. She did not announce it dramatically. She simply stopped coming around. Daniel did not take it well. He began drinking more than before, not the light social drinking of evenings with friends, but the serious, dedicated drinking of a man trying to silence something loud inside his own head. His farming became erratic, The plot of land he had sometimes tended fell into disrepair. Without Loveth's income supplementing the household, the practical reality of what he had always dismissed as her small selling became devastatingly clear. He began to owe people. He borrowed from friends, then from neighbours, then from sources in town that charged interest rates that only made things worse. His temper, without a wife to absorb it, turned outward onto friends, onto strangers, onto anyone unfortunate enough to cross him on a bad day. He lost allies quickly that way. Men who had once called him a friend began making themselves scarce. He got sick. It started with his stomach, likely from the drinking and the irregular eating, then a persistent fever, then something with his joints that made it painful to walk far. He went to the village medicine man first, then to the clinic in town, and what they told him was serious enough that he had to accept he needed proper treatment in a real hospital. He had no money. He sold what little remained of the household items he had let fall apart around him. He borrowed again. He asked family members who gave reluctantly and with visible judgment, and eventually, still not well, still struggling, he heard through a distant connection that there was opportunity for casual labour or assistance in Ibadan, that the city always needed workers, always needed people willing to start at the bottom. He packed a small bag. He went to Ibadan. He had not thought about where Loveth was. He had convinced himself, in the way of a man whose pride is stronger than his memory, that she had probably married someone else already, probably failed, probably regretted leaving. He told himself these things because the alternative that she had left and survived and built something was not a story his ego could comfortably hold. He walked into a large provision store near the center of Ibadan. He had heard they were hiring for deliveries. The store was well stocked, well organized, clean in a way that spoke of careful management. A young woman at the front desk looked up when he entered. "Good afternoon. How can I help you?" "I am looking for work," he said. "I heard you need delivery men." "Let me check with the owner." She gestured to a chair. "Please sit. She will be with you shortly." He waited. He looked around the store. He noted the goods arranged neatly on shelves. He noted the two young women working efficiently behind the counter. He noted the framed business registration on the wall, the name of the shop printed in clean letters, Destiny Provisions Est by L. Ezer. He was still reading the name on the wall when the door to the back office opened, and Loveth walked out. She almost didn't see him at first. She was looking down at the clipboard in her hand, reviewing a delivery list, moving with the efficient, grounded energy of someone who knew exactly where they were and what they were doing. Then she looked up. The clipboard did not fall. Her face did not crumple. Her hands did not shake. She simply stopped walking. And she looked at him. He had aged. Not in the way of years alone, but in the way that happens when a person has been fighting forces, they created themselves a particular exhaustion around the eyes, a looseness in the jaw, a way of standing that was smaller than she remembered. The arrogance was still faintly present, but it was the arrogance of a flame in the wind flickering, uncertain of its own ability to stay lit. "Loveth," he said. His voice came out rough, unfamiliar with itself. She said,
"Let's see how far it's going to go, ne?"
Moment. She looked at him the way you look at something you once feared and have since outgrown. "Daniel," she said finally. "Simply. The way you name a thing that no longer has power over you." His throat moved. "I came to look for work. I did not know this was... He stopped. He gestured vaguely at the space around them, at the full shelves, the clean floors, the humming activity of her business. How did you find Ibadan? She asked. Still calm, still measured. It has been difficult, he said. The words came out smaller than he intended. My health. Things did not go well. He looked at her hands, no longer rough the way he remembered, or rather, still strong, but different now. The strength belonging to something built, rather than something endured. He looked at her face, and saw what years had done. Not erased her, not broken her, but refined her, the way fire does to metal, taking away everything unnecessary and leaving only what is true. He started to cry. He did not plan to. He had not cried in years, not because he felt nothing, but because he had spent years constructing a version of himself for whom tears were weakness. But standing here in the store that bore his daughter's name, looking at the woman he had choked against a wall, he could not hold it. I thought you would never survive without me, he said. The words came out broken, ragged with the shame of being true. I told myself, I told everyone that you would fail, that you needed me. Loveth looked at him for a long, quiet moment. The day you held my neck, she said at last, her voice even and clear as a bell, was the day I stopped being your wife and started fighting for my life. He put his hand over his face. She let him cry. She did not comfort him. She did not rage at him. She simply stood in the middle of the store she had built with her own hands and let the truth of what he had done and what she had become exist in the space between them without interference. After a long moment, she spoke again. Destiny is well, she said. She is healthy, she is happy, she is in school, and she is doing very well. She paused. She does not ask about you. He flinched as if she had struck him. I heard you are sick, she continued. I will send you something for the hospital. Not because I owe you anything, not because I am coming back, but because I have made my peace, and holding bitterness in my hands would only slow them down. He looked up. His eyes were red. Can I see her? Destiny? Lover thought about this for a moment. A long moment. She thought about Destiny on her back in that hut, screaming while her father's hands were around her mother's throat. She thought about the little girl who now laughed freely, who learned her letters with excitement, who had never once in Ibadan looked over her shoulder with fear. One day, she said, when she is old enough to choose for herself, that decision will be hers, not mine. It was more than he deserved. He knew it. He did not argue. She called her front desk employee over and gave a few quiet instructions. A small envelope was prepared enough for hospital bills, for transport, for the immediate need. She handed it to him herself. He took it with both hands, the way you receive something you know you have not earned. Loveth, he said. I am sorry. She nodded. The nod said, I hear you. It did not say it was all right, because it was not all right. It had never been all right. But she was no longer living inside the years when it had happened, and she refused to drag those years into the future she had built. Go and get well, Daniel, she said. And she walked back toward her office, the clipboard in her hand, the business humming around her, her daughter's name on the wall above the door. News travels in ways that cannot always be traced. By the time the story of Loveth's encounter with Daniel reached Oke-Ilu, it had grown and shifted the way all stories do when they travel through mouths and distances. But the heart of it remained intact. The woman they had watched leave with nothing had returned to the world as something, and the man who had held her down had come to a door needing help. Mama Blossom heard the story from a trader who had heard it from a neighbor who had cousins in Ibadan. She sat with it for a while, the way she sat with most important things. Then she went inside her compound and gave thanks in her quiet, private way for the young woman she had watched leave in the night, and for the God who had, as she had always believed he would, seen every tear and silent suffering and refused to let it be the end of the story. Daniel returned to Oke-Ilu after his treatment. He was quieter now. The drinking became less. The bragging stopped entirely. He lived alone in the hut, older and less certain of himself. And the village gave him a wide berth, not from cruelty, but from the natural distance people place between themselves and a cautionary tale. He had lost everything. He had dismissed as unimportant. His wife, his child, his respect, the warmth of a home that someone else made warm, the sound of his daughter's voice, the particular dignity of being loved by a good woman. He could not get any of it back. Loveth did not return to Oke-Ilu. She had no reason to. Her life was in Ibadan, now in the store with her daughter's name above the door. In Destiny's school reports that she read with tears of pride in the Wednesday evening meetings with the community women's cooperative she had joined and later helped lead. Her life was in the early morning prayers, before the city woke up, in the smell of dried fish and palm oil that no longer felt like burden, but like purpose. In the sound of her own voice firm, unhurried and free giving instructions in the store she had built with hands that had once only known how to carry someone else's weight. She had not forgotten what she had endured. She would not forget it. But she had refused to let it be the whole of her story. She had chosen to make it only the beginning, the hard, dark beginning that made everything that came after shine more clearly. Destiny, now 7 years old, sometimes asked about her father. Loveth always answered honestly, in the careful language of a mother who understood that truth is better than invented comfort. "Your father and I could not stay together," she would say. "That was not your fault, and it will never be your fault. You are the best thing that happened to me. You are the reason I got up every morning and decided to be more." And Destiny would nod, the way children nod at things they half understand and will fully understand later, and then she would go back to her schoolwork or her playing, confident in the unshakable warmth of her mother's love. The hut in Oke-Ilu, where firewood had once fallen and a woman had once clawed for air, slowly fell into disrepair. Weeds grew at the entrance, the clay walls faded, the compound that had once held so much pain became just another quiet corner of a village that moved on the way villages always do. But in Ibadan, a light was on, a store was open. A woman was behind the counter, and a girl was doing her homework at the back table, and everything was exactly as hard and exactly as good as life is when you have chosen it freely. Cheating destroys more than a marriage. It destroys the fragile trust that holds a family together. Violence in a home is never love, no matter how it is explained or excused. A woman who endures is not a weak woman, but a woman who chooses herself is a brave one. The person you reduce to nothing today may become the one you must bow to tomorrow. Pride and cruelty always find their answer in time. Walking away from what is killing you is not failure. It is the first, hardest, most necessary step toward everything you were meant to become. God sees every tear, every silent suffering, every midnight prayer whispered into the dark by a woman carrying too much. He sees it all, and he does not forget. When the world holds you down, do not let it be the end of your story. Let it be only the first chapter, the one that makes all the chapters after it matter. Loveth's story does not end in that hut. It ends in the morning. It ends with her name above the door. It ends with her daughter's laugh. It ends with her own hands, free and strong, and finally, her own. If this story touched your heart, don't forget to subscribe to our channel.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful and pleasant evening. Ciao, ciao, and see you on Sunday, okay?